quietest moments I wish I knew what I had to do. And even though the sun is shining, well, I feel the rain. Here it comes again, dear. And even when you showed me my heart was out of tune, but there's a shadow of doubt that's not letting me find you too soon. The music that you gave me, the language of my soul, thought I wanted it with you. Won't you let me come in from the cold? Even though the stars are glistening and the ocean's deep, I just go to sleep. And then I create the silent movie. You become the star. Is that what you are, dear? Your whisper tells a secret. Your laughter brings me joy, and a wonder of feeling that nature's only poor boy. But still the tears keep falling, they're raining from the sky. Well, there's a ladder they got to go under before I get high.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's Monday night call, conference call. Today is Monday, June 17th, 2019. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-475-3250, and our access code is 449389#. If anybody would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions@nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Tonight's scripture reading is going to be in John chapter 19. Gospel of John, chapter 19, verses 31 through 42. The Jews, therefore, because it was preparation that the body should not remain upon the cross on the Sabbath day, for that Sabbath day was a high day, besought Pilate that their legs might be broken, and that they might be taken away. Then came the soldiers and brake the legs of the first and of the other, which was crucified with him. But when they came to Jesus and saw that he was dead already, they brake not his legs. But one of the soldiers with a spear pierced his side, and forthwith came out blood and water. And he that saw it bare record, and his record is true, and he knoweth that he saith truth, that ye might believe. For these things were done, that the scriptures might be fulfilled: a bone of him shall not be broken. And again another scripture saith, they shall look on him whom they have pierced. And after this Joseph of Arimathea, being a disciple of Jesus, secretly, for fear of the Jews, besought Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus, and Pilate gave him leave. He came therefore and took the body of Jesus. And there came also Nicodemus, which at first came to Jesus by night, and brought a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pounds weight. Then took they the body of Jesus and wound it in a linen cloth with the spices, as the manner of the Jews is to bury. Now in the place where he was crucified there was a garden, and in the garden a new sepulchre, wherein was never a man yet laid. There they laid Jesus, because the Jews' preparation day for the sepulture was nigh at hand. Okay, that was the Gospel, John chapter 19, verses 31 through 42.
Okay, tonight's topic is going to be challenging jurisdiction. Anybody wants to follow along, you can find this at our website, nationallibertyalliance.org. Click on Due Process, come to the bottom of the page, and click on the Access button. And I think it's the second set of papers down. It says Show Cause for Jurisdiction. So that's what we're going to look at tonight. And it's a pretty short one, I think. Probably shouldn't take much more than 15 minutes to read through it, but it's got a lot of great stuff in it. And then after that, we'll figure out what we'll do after that, because I haven't planned for anything tonight except for that. So let's take a look at that, and then we'll move into the next step. Probably open up for some questions that have been mailed, and then take some questions.
Okay, this is a verified show cause denial of jurisdiction. If anybody would like to read along with this, you can get a copy up on our website, nationallibertyalliance.org. Click on the Due Process tab on the blue bar. Come down to click here to enter, and you should be able to find it down there under denial of jurisdiction or challenge, instructions and forms to challenge jurisdiction. We have it both in PDF and also in Word. We have the show cause of jurisdiction, which is the paper we're going to be reading tonight. Also, we have a notice of motion. We have a file on demand, affidavit of service, and an affidavit of default. And we have the instructions for challenging the jurisdiction also. We have all of this in both PDF and in Microsoft Word. Okay, so verified show cause, denial of jurisdiction. Of course, you have to fill out the paperwork accordingly. Up on the top, it needs the name of the court, the address, city, state, and zip. And then, of course, the petitioner, and list the petitioner's name and also the respondents. And it is also a sworn statement. So right on the top, we have your state and your county. And it's a sworn statement, and it starts this way. I, put in your name, one of the people of your state, competent to defend myself in a court of law, hereinafter petitioner by special appearance, for the purpose of testing the sufficiency of the jurisdiction of the above said court. Petitioner hereby opens a court of record to move the above said court to a court of record for cause and dismissal for lack of personam jurisdiction in violation of petitioner's right of due process in a court not of record. Under federal law, which is applicable in all states, the U.S. Supreme Court stated, if a court is without authority, its judgments and orders are regarded as nullities. They are not voidable, but simply void, and form no bar to a recovery sought, even prior to a reversal in opposition to them. They constitute no justification, and all persons concerned in executing such judgments or sentences are considered in law as trespassers. Respondents are to show cause by what constitutional authority the above said court acts, and why the attached violations or charges against the petitioner should not be dismissed for lack of personam jurisdiction. In the United States, before any court can have authority to hear a case, the court must have both in personam and subject matter jurisdiction. Any court not of a court of record has no authority to proceed without the consent of the persons involved. A court of record is a superior court. A court not of record is an inferior court. No judge or legislators can alter that which the people ordained. To alter is high treason. Number one, respondents, having no agreement with petitioner, conspired under the color of law in a nisi prius de facto quasi court not of record proceeding in equity and not at law, depriving petitioners unalienable rights of due process secured by the Bill of Rights with the intent to proceed unlawfully, carrying petitioner away to jurisdictions unknown. Number two, service of an appearance ticket on an accused does not confer personal or subject matter jurisdiction upon a criminal court. Number three, trial courts act without jurisdiction and it acts without inherent or common law authority. Number four, inferior courts are those whose jurisdiction is limited and special and whose proceedings are not according to the course of the common law. Criminal courts proceed according to statutory law. Jurisdiction and procedure is defined by statute. Likewise, civil courts and admiralty courts proceed according to the statutory law. Any court proceeding according to statutory law is not a court of record, which only proceeds according to the common law. It is an inferior court. Respondents, not being able to prove a claim and fiduciary authority over the petition is necessary for a lawful seizure of body and or property in a court of record, conspired and devised a plan under the color of law to bypass petitioner's unalienable right of due process in a court not of record in jurisdictions unknown. Number six, respondents are fraudulently denying petitioner's unalienable right of due process in a court of record proceeding according to natural law protected by Amendments 5 and 7. Number seven, American courts are vested by the people, the author and source of law, through constitutions ordained by the people. Therefore, a court must have constitutional authority over an individual before it can proceed. The common law permits the destruction of the abatement of nuisances by summary proceedings. 16 American Jurisprudence, 2nd edition, section 114. As to the construction, with reference to common law, an important canon of construction is that the Constitution must be construed to reference to the common law. The common law so permitted destruction of the abatement of nuisance by summary proceedings, and it was never supposed that a constitutional provision was intended to interfere with this established principle. And although there is no common law of the United States in the sense of a national customary law as distinguished from the common law of England adopted in the several states, in interpreting the federal constitution, recourse may still be had to the aid of common law of England. It has been said that without reference to the common law, the language of the federal constitution could not be understood. Therefore, since the Constitution must be construed to reference the common law, summary proceedings would deny petitioners' Seventh Amendment right of a trial by jury, and thereby would be repugnant, rendering any such decisions null and void. No sanctions can be opposed absent proof of jurisdiction. No judicial process, whatsoever form it may assume, can have any lawful authority outside of the limits of the jurisdiction of a court or judge by whom it is issued. And any attempt to enforce it beyond these boundaries is nothing less than lawless violence. No court has discretion to ignore its lack of jurisdiction. The law requires proof of jurisdiction to appear on the record of the administrative agency and all administrative proceedings. A court cannot confer jurisdiction where none exists and cannot make a void proceeding valid. It is clear and well-established law that a void order can be challenged in any court. Therefore, the burden shifts to the court to prove jurisdiction on the record. All jurisdiction facts related to the jurisdiction asserted. Where a court failed to observe safeguards, it amounts to denial of due process of law. The court is deprived of jurisdiction. In criminal cases, a court must have an indictment by an untainted, non-statutory grand jury. In other words, the permission by the people to proceed. Furthermore, all state laws and constitutions are ultimately governed by the supremacy clause of the Constitution for the United States of America, as ordained by the people in Article 6, Clause 2, that defines the law of the land. Once challenged, jurisdiction cannot be assumed. It must be proved to exist. However late this objection has been made, or may be made in the cause, in an inferior or appellate court of the United States, it must be considered and decided before any court can move one further step in the cause. As any movement is necessary, the exercise of jurisdiction. If any tribunal finds absence of proof of jurisdiction over the person and subject matter, the case must be dismissed. Finally, jurisdiction cannot be decided by the court being challenged. This court must dismiss this case for lack of personam jurisdiction immediately or make an argument for jurisdiction in a court of record. Refusal by this court, not of record, to obey the law and pursue a voidable decision will cause the petitioner to move this case into federal court for cause in violation of petitioner's right of due process for damages and dismissal. Wherefore, petitioner denies this court's personam jurisdiction and moves this court to cease and desist with prejudice from all actions against the petitioner and restore the petitioner to their original state for lack of constitutional authority and personam jurisdiction. Failure of the officers of this court to comply with the law of the land and their oaths to the law will result in further actions in federal courts charging 18 U.S.C. subsection 241 conspiracy against rights, 18 U.S.C. subsection 242 deprivation of rights, and restitution as required by common law. Then there's a place here, this is the end, and you sign your name, and it's in pro per, the best way to come in your own person, in pro per, in your own person. If you have a seal, you put a seal right under the word seal. If you don't have a seal, then the word seal should suffice, but everyone should go out and get their own seal if they're going to participate in the courts. That's something we could discuss if people want to get some information on a seal. Now, this paper was written, and it's got quite a few. It's got 36 footnotes in the entire paper, so people should read through it again and check out the footnotes, which gives the authorities and the sources of all of the things that we've quoted and spoke here. Of course, you have to fill out the information accordingly throughout the paper. There's a couple of places, just generally in the beginning, you have to put your name and your state. And, of course, in the end, you have to sign it. And this is a sworn statement, so it has to be notarized and then sent in. If this paper fails, and let's say the court you're in tries to deny that that they don't have jurisdiction, you have to tell them that that they're biased, that judge needs to recuse themselves because they're biased. They already believe they got jurisdiction. And they'll usually do this before an argument is made by the prosecutor to show that they have jurisdiction. And so, therefore, that even proves the fact that they're biased and they're working off their own decision-making and not considering the argument before the court, because they can only go as far as the argument before the court. One side says one thing, the other side has to rebut it and come up with an opposition to that. And of course, you have to then rebut anything that they added to that paper that they've filed. Of course, they can't possibly rebut this argument. If the judge tries to claim jurisdiction after, even though nothing from the prosecutor to argue that case, Then they refuse to move it. That's the other thing. You want to tell the judge that this has to be moved into a court of record. And so you're probably in a county court or something lower than a county court, maybe a town court or a village court or a city court. You want it moved into the state court. And that's where the decision needs to be made. Now, if it does get moved into the state court and the positions are made, the argument is made, you should win on its face because this paper here is self-evident. Every paragraph, every sentence is self-evident. Whatever they have to say on the other side, they'd probably ignore a lot of things. But, however they respond, whatever they don't respond to, then you file a paper responding back to that other paper, making the point that they have defaulted because they have acquiesced, they've agreed to each one of these points that they did not respond to. And you list them, you write them in the paper, and this paper should be moving the court for a dismissal because they defaulted, they acquiesced. And that's a paper people would have to write on their own. It's pretty simple, same format, you use a heading. And again, you should do that also. It's got to be a affidavit of default. And so at the bottom, of course, you have to put the affidavit form and have it signed before a notary. And now if all of this fails, there are two options people have. They could move it into federal court for cause and make the argument there. You should win, providing you're capable of making that argument in the court. It should be all paperwork. You shouldn't have to really go into the court to make any oral arguments. And you shouldn't, of course, request that. Paper is the best way to go with this. So you file into the court and you make your paper. Accordingly, we have a form for that on moving to federal court for cause. And again, you should win. Or the second option, you can petition the grand jury. You can get information how to petition the grand jury at intake@nationallibertyalliance.org. And with that petition, we will then move your case into the federal court that we're filing our case in, and we will push it forward to get it decided on. And we will move it forward for a decision, and if they don't make the proper decision, then we will probably pursue indictments at that point. All right, that's pretty much it on this paper. If anybody has any questions on it, we can discuss it when we do the open forum. Okay, Jen, do we have any questions?
We have a lot of questions, John.
Okay, we'll take a few. We don't want to tie up too much time, so don't let me go too long on them.
Okay, I left three easy ones on the front here. This fellow says, I received a case, or filed a case in federal district court as a plaintiff, and the magistrate sent me a notice, consent, and reference of a civil action to magistrate judge. In it, there are a bunch of judges and magistrates to choose from. Consent is voluntary. John, have you ever been royally treated like I am? Just yes or no.
Well, I guess yes. I'm not even too sure exactly what the question is on that, but yeah, you're abused in the court. Read the last part of that, because I didn't understand the last part.
Okay, this fellow filed a case in federal court, and he received from the magistrate a document that is notice, consent, and reference of a civil action to magistrate judge. In it, there are a bunch of judges and magistrates to choose from. Consent is voluntary.
Yeah, I'm not sure I understand that. I've never came up to something like that, and I'm not sure exactly what all that even means.
So, it comes out of Florida. I'm not sure exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't have an answer for that, because I'm not really understanding the question. It's not clear enough for me.
He's definitely in a civil side of the action.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, I don't understand that he gets to choose people or something, or a judge. You know, they have a process where, you know, it's sort of like a lottery process. But
it sounds like down there they let the person choose who they want for a judge for some reason.
I've never heard that before. I'd be looking for one who obeys the law, you know.
Okay, number two. My daughter would not plea in traffic court. So now the court decided to give her a trial by jury. I've been told to write up an affidavit challenging jurisdiction. What types of facts should I include? How do I want to word the justification challenge?
Well, it's simple. Traffic court doesn't have jurisdiction. It's statutory, therefore not a court of record. Therefore, they have to get your approval to join in. They usually do that by pleading. And then they'll try to press it forward, and they'll make believe that they're going to come with a jury. But the jury, usually in a traffic court, it's like six people or something. It's not even a real jury. And the other thing is it's statutory, and they're going to rule on statutes. And there's a whole different process that's going to go through, and everyone's going to believe the cop ultimately, you know, that gave you the ticket, and those are the facts. The judge is going to have to tell them that, rule on those facts, and if they broke the law, the ticket, then, you know, then whatever that violation was, then they're guilty of it. But the only way to get out of that is challenge jurisdiction. We read that tonight on the jurisdiction challenge. You can go up on to nationallibertyalliance.org, click on due process, come down to the bottom of the page, click on the enter button, and it's the second section down. It says instructions and forms to challenge jurisdiction. And I don't think I mentioned this, all of this, you know, we have, of course, the show cause of jurisdiction. And when I wrote that, this has changed a few times. I'm not sure whether the right one is up on the website yet, but I'll double check that probably tomorrow and make sure that the right one is up there, because we've been updating these forms all weekend. And I think we pretty much have everything, you know, to where it belongs now. Anyway, you have to do this. You know, you have to do a notice of motion, okay? I'm not sure whether that's absolutely necessary, but it's not going to hurt. And to some degree it is, because you got to serve the prosecutor on the other side a notice of motion so that they know that they have to respond to something. And that's why they make you do a paper that covers a cover sheet. I think ours is a two-page cover sheet, but it could be one page. I don't remember. But that's there. All the information of writing it is up there. The show cause jurisdiction, which we read tonight, is up there. Only have to fill in some basic details. We give also instructions, and we also give an affidavit of service that the people will fill out, and also an affidavit of default, should they default, and they probably will because they won't know how to handle that. They're not going to want to let you go, and you're probably going to have to move it into the next court up yourself if the judge doesn't do it. And if that's the case, and if you lose in state court, then you go into the federal court. You should win there. You know, state court judges, you know, they're really difficult to deal with, and of course, so are all of the other judges below that in the county and the town, especially when it comes to issues like traffic and things like that. But the federal court, I don't think they're going to take the chance to try to rule in a way that would be improper. It's pretty cut and dry, and I don't think there'd be an injury to the judge in the sense of status quo, because judges in the federal court try to keep the status quo, but they have to do it very carefully. Anyway, next.
This is from a fellow who is on a work release program. He was sentenced to 60 days, and they're holding me past that out date. I need advice.
Well, again, you know, challenging jurisdiction, you can challenge it at any time. It doesn't matter when the case took place. If you discovered all of a sudden that your jurisdiction, that you were in a place that didn't have jurisdiction, everything they did, the sentence and everything, is null and void. So, again, I don't know. If he's got 60 days in jail, it probably was a lower court, town court, or a village court, or something of that nature. It could have been a county court, too, but I doubt it is anything in the state court. But I don't have enough information to give any more, you know, ideas or thoughts to do. Next
okay.
question.
This is a carryover from last week. We kind of got caught in the middle on this one. He was talking about moving the case to federal court, and then he was going to require each defendant to pay restitution. We got into a discussion of was it better to take $1,000 silver or whatever. So the next
question.
Well,
there's a couple of things on that. Look, at, you know, first of all, we're going in under common law. We want to try to bring things to as close as we can that's available to us to make it work on common law and stand on common law. So we should be getting real money, common law money, and that would be gold or silver. The other thing is, you know, there's an IRS game to be played here also. IRS should not or would not, from everything I understand, chase you as silver being the dollars, you know, that they have. Because, again, it's a whole different thing. That funny money doesn't have any backing. But if you're asking for silver, if you ask for $1,000 worth of silver, then at the end of the day, you know, that's valued somewhere around $18 an ounce. So that's $18 times 100 silver dollars. So that's going to be about $18,000. You can lower that. I definitely wouldn't go higher. But I'd be concerned if they want to come out after you or make a phone call or whatever. It depends on the case also. You know, you want to get it in real money. It's that simple. I wouldn't get it in the phony money.
Okay, the next question would be, and he was saying that the plaintiff demands restitution as follows, blah, blah, blah. Would this information not be needed in a notice of intent to sue to the respondent before the case is moved to district court?
Well, when you say district court, I presume he's talking about federal district court. No, you don't sue until you get to federal district court, because look, you're challenging jurisdiction, and if you can get out on challenging the jurisdiction and walk away, you do so. You take it up one level to the state court. If they won't move it into a court of record yourself, you move it into the state court. If the judge in the state court violates his oath and doesn't acknowledge the fact that you're in an equity court, or really a quasi de facto equity court in unknown jurisdictions. I mean, you don't even know what jurisdiction you're in. They don't even know whether it's criminal or civil. You know, we've seen the questions on YouTube where the judges don't even know how to answer, and I've seen it also in reality where they can't make up their mind whether it's civil or criminal. And if it's a criminal court, then, you know, the United States Supreme Court has already ruled that if you're in a criminal court, you're in a court not of record. Court of record operates by the people. The people make all the decisions. That's a court of record. If it's a criminal thing, you have to be indicted by the people, then you have to be tried by the people. And the people get to decide both, you know, the facts and the law. No influence by the judge. The judge is just the administrator of the court. He's really a magistrate. If he's an actual judge, All judges are magistrates, so he could sit as a magistrate in the court, but he can't make a decision in a court of record. Only the people can make that decision. And in reality, and this is really how far away we've come from the Constitution and the Commonwealth, in reality, the judge can't even tell you what the penalty would be. That's up to the jury. And the focus, of course, should be on restitution first and foremost. So that's the whole key to this whole thing. But and then again, you know, if it's a civil court, then you call for a court of record because it's over $20. The same rules apply. So that's the pretty much the difference. Reread the last part of that just a second to make sure I answered the question fully.
Okay. Would this information not be needed in a notice of intent to sue to the respondent before the case is moved to district court?
Oh, okay. Yeah. I guess that's pretty much put the whole thing. Once you move it into district court, now you're suing because they violated you on two different levels. They violated your unalienable right of due process. That's what they've done. They've denied you your court of record. They've refused to return you back to your own court. Your own court is a court of record where you have the opportunity to be tried by your peers, peers that have been untainted, unadulterated, so to speak. You know, once they violate the jury and they start talking statutes and everything else, that's jury tampering in a court of record. Next question.
Okay, this is a... Oh, he has one more. Could other restitutions be awarded at the same time in this said claim for common law trespass and return of property, children, by using the Carl Linz method?
Yeah, you know, I'm not too familiar with the Carl Linz method. I know Gerard is but I don't think he's here. I don't see him in here, so
no,
he could respond to that. I can't. But, you know, look, at yeah, it is true that they it ultimately is a fraud on the court. I mean, ultimately. And they violated your right of due process. And that's what you go and sue for. And I would only sue for one issue, and that's a due process issue. You can add a couple if you want. But yeah, you can't get crazy with money. People get crazy with money. I've seen people do these things and they won $100 million. That's ridiculous. And you know, again, we have to be reasonable. But next.
Okay, this next one is kind of involved. It's the woman who was taking care of her mother, and then the state moved in, Center for Elder Care, took over her mother, and they sold off her home and two rental properties that her mother owned. And she tried to stop the sale by filing a Linz pendency, and so they have her trying her for contempt of court for doing that and so on. So she is now preparing the documents that you've mentioned on the call to challenge jurisdiction.
That's the way to go, challenge jurisdiction. Yeah. Doesn't matter when you found out. Once you found out, And remember, there's no statute of limitation in common law, so you can sue something from 10 years ago. The problem with suing for something 10 years is finding the witnesses, getting all the evidence freshly together, which may be impossible, but then it may not. In a case of jurisdiction, of course, they're supposed to have a record, so that record exists, and it shouldn't be a problem. And, of course, the record of whatever penalties or whatever sales or whatever they sold, whatever they did, okay, is all somewhat recorded. So you can go back and say, I want my money back and I want everything else back. Again, you know, you take it through the process.
Okay, her question then would be, what president's name do I need to address?
One other thing. You stay simply on challenging jurisdiction. Because once you win the jurisdiction that they didn't have it, and again, I believe once you get into the federal level, I doubt they'll deny and try to railroad you, unless they really feel that you're not a threat to them in some way, they might. But in these areas, they probably won't get involved until try to maintain status quo. And it'd be difficult for them to throw you out because you're moving a case for cause. And as long as you stay with that focus, you know, with that it's a constitutional issue, you're only there to argue the constitutional issue. Anyway, once you get that from the court, a ruling, that they did not have jurisdiction, case closed and everything else. You don't even have to fight it in court. It's almost, you go for summary judgment with the default papers. They owe you everything to bring it back. So restitution and return of property and so on.
Okay.
Okay. Now, the question is, what president's name do I need to address? The one I dealt with in 2013 and 14 retired. Should I address this to the current president of the bank or include both the previous and current president?
Wow, that's a good question. I'd go after the CEO or the president that was original. Let me think about this. Well, he's representing the corporation. Again, if he's a president, I got to believe he holds a good amount of stock. That being the case, he's responsible. So it's difficult to figure that out, but I would go towards the ones that violated you. The new ones didn't.
Okay. Then the second question would be, should I address all the mortgage services and the people that we communicate with or just the main people?
I don't understand that question. The mortgage people, the main, I don't know what that means.
The people that they deal with in the mortgage services or dealt with.
Well, you don't sue the people per se. You're suing the individuals who are breaking the law. Again, if this is a, I'm presuming he's talking about a case that's a non-judicial foreclosure. That's what I presume they're doing. And that being the case, then you stay focused on the people who have benefited from that. And that would be, of course, the judge and the lawyer has some benefit there, but definitely the owner of the company. You go after the president of a board. That would be the individual you want to go after.
So, okay, which clerk of court to address if the one was involved in the foreclosure process is no longer there?
Again, I don't know what they mean when they're talking about the court, the clerk of court. You know, there are two clerks you have to deal with, one on the state level. I presume, I don't know if it's a state case, I don't know, you know, it's a village, town, or what, so I really don't know. But generally speaking, if you're filing papers with the court, if it's a state court, you're dealing with the county clerk. Even though there are many court clerks, it's the one that was elected. That's the key. That's the person you need to deal with. But again, the clerk, let me think about this. You know, the clerk, you shouldn't really be involved in these kinds of cases. There are issues or situations where they are, but not that I, and again, I don't know enough about the case, so can't answer much more than that.
Okay. Now, this next one is really convoluted. I'm not sure if we should go into it or not.
Well, pick it up next week if it's going to be a long one. You got any short ones? Because we're going to want to move on.
I'll give you a short one. Wood County, West Virginia, is demanding proof of payment of property taxes before renewing car registration.
Yeah, that's real weird. Yeah, I'm seeing and hearing that now, and that's very, very strange, and it's more violations. I don't know that you're going to be able to defeat that easily in the court. It's going to get involved. It is an issue that we will deal with as time goes on. But again, first the people have to take back control of their courts, and until that happens, we're not going to get any justice probably in those areas. It'll be an uphill battle. Not that you can't win it. You could possibly win it. And again, they're going to violate your rights, so you'll end up with constitutional issues that you'll have to bring into the federal court, and that'll help to build and you know, fortify your case to some degree. But again, you know, don't have enough. What else? Any other short ones?
Yeah. My case is a judicial foreclosure. Which part should I join? I wish to join your case first, challenge jurisdiction, and then join, correct? Could you please review?
Well, it depends. If people can do it themselves, they should challenge the jurisdiction and then see if they could move it along themselves. If they can't, then they can move it into our court, the federal court, move it in there and join us there. There's very specific issues about joining cases. It has to be something that affects many people. The issue has to be something that affects many people on a statewide or nationwide, you know, situation. And these cases clearly do because they're way out of control. This is nationwide in every state, every county, everywhere. They're taking properties away from people unlawfully. Okay, and the courts are working with them to do this. So.
You know, the other situation you could do is you can come straight to us, and we can file the an amicus curiae in the court for you concerning jurisdiction, get that process taken care of and moved along. Maybe they'll fix everything and everything will be well, but if they don't, then we can then move it into the federal court as a joiner. Let me tell you, there's so many issues, so many people in every state, you know, with habeas corpus problems, non-judicial foreclosure problems, courts that they're in courts not of record, you know, the jurisdictions are improper. Just many, many things. The paperwork is improper. Signatures aren't there. Courts are opened without any affidavits, and they come after and pursue you, even though there's no affidavits to support anything. On a federal level or any way where they, well, actually on every level they have to be able to show it, they're taking over your property in some way, like in a process in REM, for instance. They have to show some fiduciary authority over you. And, of course, they have to show proof of some kind of a claim. These are two major issues, and those are both have to be in affidavit form. And rarely, you very rarely see anything like that. I've never seen them, matter of fact. I'm aware of them. I know the federal forms that could be filled out. It's the 4490 and the Form 56. So it's Form 4490 and Form 56. So if they take anything from you in REM, R-E-M, which is how the tax people take it from you, you know, then you can hit them up and say, hey, you file the 4490 or the Form 56 in the federal court. Where is that? They'll never do it. They can't do it because they have to make sworn statements, and who's going to reach their hand and commit the fraud and lie? So they're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. You can push those issues on them. So even though it may be in a county court or a town, well, I don't know the town courts. Let me think. Yeah, town courts do actually go through this process more often than not. But it could be a town court or a village court or even a county court. And again, they'll try to push it, and they don't have any authority. But what's next?
Okay, new topic. I have filled out a notice of motion and verified show cause to the best of my belief. It's correct. It's a foreclosure case in an equity court in New Jersey. My understanding is I send it to the plaintiff and court and to stop further action, and then I can fill out forms to join your case against the judiciary next, or do you need them all at once beforehand?
I'm very confused. Well, again, you know, people can pursue these cases on their own if they're capable of doing that, and you know, again, if you don't know the procedures and the processes, they're going to throw you out on little things, you know, and they'll frustrate you, and you'll find yourself going back in. Maybe if you're paying for this, and even though you don't want to pay for it, they're going to force you to pay for it on the state level anyway. You know, it becomes a problem if you don't know what you're doing. So if you're unsure, you know, you can talk to intake, and we can probably work something out with the taking care of the paper. Again, first order of business is challenge jurisdiction. In the non-judicial foreclosures, really, we operate a little differently on that. We let them know that they don't that they're being used in a fraud situation, and we explain how the crime has taken place and how the mortgage companies are using the courts to leverage the courts to take away people's properties with unconstitutional non-judicial foreclosures. Just think of the name, non-judicial foreclosures, you know. That in itself shows that it's unconstitutional. But the courts are playing ball with them, so that's the other problem. And so if you kind of challenge that and the court gets a little frightened, you might win. If not, you'll have to sue that court also. You remember, a court of record can sue any court underneath it, and all courts are underneath the court of record, save the court of record itself. It's a superior court.
Okay. Are you familiar with the National Currency Act, John? Have you studied that?
National Currency Act. I might be, but it doesn't ring a bell per se. Did they explain anything in that?
Well, this person is highly concerned about that National Currency Act to trump these attacks on homes in regards to Title So-and-So, Section Such-and-Such. For one thing, when you deposit a promissory note, it becomes cash to the bank and so on and so forth. And he's just wondering what we might be able to do about all that.
Well, there's a federal statute out there that states very clearly that the instrument of a dollar, okay, is payable in gold or silver to anybody who takes it to a federal bank and demands it. It's payable on demand. And that's very interesting because the language is very clear. It says a dollar, okay? It doesn't say a silver certificate. It just says a dollar. And that being the case, $1 is $1 in, as far as real money is concerned, is a dollar in silver or a dollar in gold. And as strange as it may be, I think it's something that they didn't, they missed. I don't know what it is, but they missed it, I think. I wrote a paper on that. I forget exactly where we put it. Maybe I haven't filed to put it up on the site yet. I don't remember. But it's something I'm looking a little more into to see. They may be in trouble with that. That's a problem for them. Other than that, I don't know anything else.
Okay, that's the last question.
Okay. Yeah, that other one we'll take maybe next week because it's coming up on 10 o'clock, and you see Brent is here, so we want to move over to him in a few minutes. Do we have any announcements?
No, not really.
Okay. All right, just as far as things we're doing, everything is updated up as far as the paperwork is concerned. I will double-check that tomorrow and make sure that we do have the proper papers that have been updated on the website that people use. And also, we've made things a lot easier in order to join us. And again, you know, we've changed the paperwork on that, and it's just filling out a form. And then you put it into intake at nationallibertyalliance.org. James will get back to you, and he'll prepare the petition for you to sign and get notarized and then return to us, and then we pick it up from there. So he'll go through all the instructions. We do have the instructions pretty much written down. We've been playing around with those instructions quite a bit, trying to get the wording right so it's clear. But if it's not clear enough, James will make it clearer in the process as you go through. All right, if that's it, we'll move forward. That's it? I guess so. Okay. All right, we're going to move to Brent. Brent Winters is the author of The Excellence of the Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com. Brent, you got the mic. I see he's muted. Oh, he muted, unmuted. Okay, good.
I'm good. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
This is Brent. Yeah, this is Brent Allen Winters. CommonLawyer.com, www.commonlawyer.com. You can join us on Saturday mornings. We went through 45 weeks of common law evidence, the law of evidence, the common law of evidence, I should say. And now we're going through, Lord willing, 45 weeks of the common law of promises, often called the common law of contracts, the law of contracts. We're probably about a dozen weeks into it. You can join us. You go to commonlawyer.com, and you can go to the events button. And there's a link there you can click on, and you can see me, but I can't see you. And usually I'll talk for 45 minutes or so, and then there are little assignments you can do. When it's done, you can get a certificate. I want to provide a certificate that could, there's no reason why it shouldn't be acceptable in some places for credit. Depends on how much confidence a school has, but some have done it. But 45 weeks of going through the assignments are simple, and they don't take long. I want to make it enjoyable, not unenjoyable. It's enjoyable for me to listen to what people say and the little assignments they do, which takes just a few minutes. Try to engage the arts of freedom, as I call them, the arts of freedom, known as the arts of liberty or the liberal arts. the liberal arts, the arts of freedom, are only four. They are the arts of language, all four of them. Reading, writing, listening, and speaking. We try to bring them all to bear in our coursework. And then you can join us on Sunday mornings if you're so inclined. We're going through the book of Revelation of the seer, John the Apostle, the last book of the Bible, clause by clause, blow by blow. But right now we're going through the Constitution of the United States, and we've been sailing through that. I should say we're snorkeling across the top of it, and when we see something of interest, we pike and dive, and then when we run out of air, we come back up. Well, the things I say here are my comments, not necessarily the points of view of National Liberty Alliance, but they're kind enough to let me talk. So we're going through the Constitution of the United States. We've been talking about habeas corpus. Habeas corpus means we have the body. The body of what? Well, the body of the prisoner. The writ of habeas corpus, a writ, is a command from a greater to a lesser at common law. The old Anglo-Dane way of saying writing is writ, something that's in writing. That's what it is. And a writ of habeas corpus is a command by a court to a jailer, whether he be a hospital or a military brig, army barracks, a navy brig, county jail, federal prison, whatever. Anybody holding somebody and under arrest is in jail. False imprisonment, common law calls it. And if a judge says, bring the body, habeas corpus, we have the body, bring the body of the prisoner in front of my court forthwith and prove to me that you are imprisoning this person lawfully. And if you don't do that, I'm going to let him go on the spot. That's habeas corpus. It's a safeguard against false imprisonment. It's our common law's way of guarding against false imprisonment. And I want to drop another footnote. Why is false imprisonment a wrong? It's a wrong at common law. And the reason for that is historical. As Justice Holmes said of the Supreme Court, a page of history can be worth volumes of logic. No, it's the other way around. No, a page of history can be worth volumes of logic. So the history of false imprisonment goes back to our earliest, our English-speaking world's earliest contact with the writings we call the Bible. Because the most fundamental command of our Maker is that we scatter across the faces of the land. And we are to do that upon impulse. And we do it, and we have done it. That's why we live on this side of the world. And we don't live on the other side of the world, because those that have gone before us decided to come over here. Some people came over here against their will. Like the people down in Australia, when they started, the people, it was a penal colony. That's where they banished people. And the first people that went there that were from Europe were prisoners. And the descendants of those prisoners now runs into the millions down there, by the way. But it's all about scattering out, and false imprisonment impedes God's covenant. And if you want to read about what our Maker thinks about scattering out, go to Genesis chapter 11 and read that chapter. It'll tell you there what happened to the first incident on record where people tried to keep people from scattering out, and it all came down to the law of the city at a place called Babylon, where the law of the city under the first true emperor of the world, a fellow by the name of Nimrod, established in sophisticated form the law of the city with intent to keep people from scattering. That's why, by the way, another footnote to the footnote, the right to travel is a fundamental right under our Constitution. Not listed, but encompassed in that 10th Amendment, where it says that not all the rights are listed here, and if there are any others, this Constitution supports them. The right to travel is one of that. Again, it's akin to the freedom from false imprisonment and the reason for habeas corpus. So So the writ of habeas corpus commands the jailer to bring his prisoner before the court for two reasons. First, that the petitioner for habeas corpus may testify, call witnesses, cross-examine witnesses, and make oral argument about how he had not to be falsely imprisoned. Second, that if the court finds the law demands his release, the release of the prisoner, he will be set free on the spot, thereby avoiding the jailer's dallying and outright refusal. None of this stuff about, no, well, thanks, judge, for the hearing, and we'll turn him loose as soon as we get him back to jail and get him processed out. No, no. Habeas corpus demands the immediate release of the prisoner before the eyes of the judge. And by the way, habeas corpus, even though it is a common law remedy, it was first devised by Parliament, and it's legislation called the Statute of Habeas Corpus. And the Statute of Habeas Corpus from England was picked up by all of the states of the Union because we're a common law country. And each state has a statute that is very much similar, as they say in the Wabash Valley, similar to their the old writ of habeas corpus. And, of course, our Constitution of the United States, as far as the federal courts go, has ensured that the writ of habeas corpus shall never be suspended. Well, the jailing party, whether it be the sheriff, the police chief, the hospital administrator, the warden, the military officer, they must show lawful cause for jailing of the person in question. And further, the burden is on the jailer to prove the lawfulness of this, of his holding the one jailed. The burden not on the prisoner to prove that he's not being held lawfully. No, the burden is on the jailer. The one jailed need prove nothing or even say anything. In short, the one jailed doesn't even have to testify. The burden's not on him. The Habeas Corpus Act secures speedy relief from unlawful imprisonment. Perhaps, says one writer on the subject, a fellow by the name of Wright, perhaps the most important writ known to the constitutional law of England. Perhaps, he says, habeas corpus is the most important writ known to the constitutional law of England. Well, not perhaps, though. It is the greatest writ known. It's called the Great Writ, Great. In England. That's what we call it here, too. Just another point. It says, known to the constitutional law of England. Does England have a constitution? Yes. Well, where is it? Well, you can't go look at it. Why? Because it's not in writing. It's an unwritten constitution. It is the common law. That's the Constitution of England, is the common law itself. And by the way, the common law is our Constitution in America also. And our Constitution of the United States is a brief of common law government. It wasn't made out of whole cloth. It just sought to establish in firm fashion what England already had, but it was shored up in some places. And, of course, we don't have a king. We have a president, but the function is fundamentally the same. We don't have a House of Lords, but we have a Senate, and the function is fundamentally the same. We don't have a House of Commons. We have a House of Representatives, but the function is fundamentally the same, and all the relationships between the three branches of government are fundamentally the same, some variations. But we are a common law country, as is England. And our Constitution is founded upon the principles that Magna Carta had written down. Stephen Langton wrote them down in Magna Carta. And Magna Carta was just an attempt to reestablish what had been lost with the Norman invasion, going back to Alfred the Great in the year, or the ninth century, and what he had established and put down in what they called the Laws of King Alfred was just a restatement of books of the Bible, and most pronouncedly the book of Deuteronomy. But going before that, before Alfred, there were others, going back clear to the Moultine Laws of the fourth century in Britain. That's our common law. The source of our common law is lost in the fog of antiquity. No, Magna Carta is not the source of our common law. Our Constitution is not the source of our common law. And our common law is our Constitution. It has always been our Constitution. It is constituted. And without our common law, our Constitution of the United States would be utterly meaningless because it defines absolutely nothing. It just throws out words, trial by jury, right to remain silent. Well, the common law informs all those matters, and that's what our courts look to. Our common law is not what is to be done, but how it is to be done. Well, the writ of habeas corpus is in the forefront in our own day, as the federal government balks at recognizing Islamic prisoners' right to habeas corpus. And they say, well, they're not citizens of the United States. They have no right to habeas corpus. You don't have to be a citizen of the United States to have the right to habeas corpus. Our common law is the law that's common and ought to be the law of all men. It applies in every time, in every age. It is applicable, I should say, at every time, every age, every country. It's just that most countries reject it. It is the law of nature, of which our Declaration speaks. The law of nature. All men are creatures of God himself, the Creator. And if they're creatures of God himself, then the law, our common law, anciently called the law of the land and the Volkreich, our common law applies to them. So America has said, well, that is our Constitution. We take the principles of what we call the common law. They're our principles. And so if anybody under our jurisdiction, anybody that's affected by the government of the United States has a right. I don't care who they are, and I don't care where they are. If the government of the United States has acted against them in such a way as to jail them unlawfully, then the writ of habeas corpus applies. Is it possible that Islamic prisoners have been jailed unlawfully? Well, no, I think it's a foregone conclusion. It's not possible. It's been happening. And non-Islamic prisoners have been jailed. You're talking about people in the United States. Yeah, they've been jailed and accused of being Islamic, being terrorist. Yeah, we're not talking about people from the other side of the world. We're talking about white Anglo-Saxons are jailed and accused of being terrorists when they aren't. And they don't even have to accuse them of being Islamic anymore. We just say, you're a terrorist. Well, what's a terrorist? Well, a terrorist, fundamentally, in the United States today, is anyone who disagrees with a police officer or an FBI agent or anybody else in the government. You're a terrorist. That's what they say. Matter of fact, they got a list. If you say you believe in the Constitution of the United States or you're a homeschooler or you fly the flag, you're a terrorist. If you say that you don't think it's the best thing that men sodomize each other as a regular practice, well, you're a terrorist. Well, that's what they say. So my point, though, getting back to my point, and this is our common law. Our common law applies to everybody. And if the government has wronged somebody, anyone, even if they're a prisoner down at Gitmo Bay in Cuba, well, then the writ of habeas corpus applies. Be wary. I say this because I want people to know it. The federal government has said that you only have a year. Only have a year if you're pulled into federal jurisdiction and jailed anyway. You only have a year to submit a writ of habeas corpus. They put a statute of limitations on it. That's brand new. Well, brand new? New, I should say. That's unconstitutional. The writ of habeas corpus will never be suspended. They didn't suspend it. They just took it away. They said, you only got so much time. It's wholly untrue. There needs to be a movement against such evil because this is important. How important it is? Well, let me remind you and take you back to the beginning. It's as important as the fundamental covenants of God himself in the book of Genesis. That's where it comes from. False imprisonment is against the law. It's actionable. Well, to sum up, well, we talked about war. Well, war breeds dangerous state power. I didn't say that, did I? No, it does, of course. War begets powerful men, and powerful men beget more war. Thus history testifies, indeed, wartime abuses bring the necessity of habeas corpus into clearer, not more obscure focus. And all the tests, the key cases of habeas corpus, the biggest ones in our own country, have arisen out of the hype of war. and abuses of people's rights. I think I'd said Abraham Lincoln, as President of the United States, jailed over 800 persons during the course of the war over which he presided, without any hearing, without offering any trial, without submitting without submitting to any writ of habeas corpus, over 800 persons. On one particular occasion, Lincoln ordered the arrest of the entire state legislature of Maryland because he was afraid they would vote to leave the Union. Well, maybe they would have, maybe they wouldn't have, but that's a suspension of the writ of habeas corpus. Our Constitution says it shall not be suspended except, and it gives the cases there that have to do with war. You say, well, Lincoln was at war. Well, there's only one problem with that. It's clear from our common law that, and just a story makes this point, only Congress has the authority to suspend the writ of habeas corpus because only Congress has the authority to declare war. Because the writ of habeas corpus strikes at Inquisition, which is the foundation of the law of the city, the Roman civil law, Inquisition. You've heard of the Inquisitions of Spain, where the Roman church went in and used thumbscrews and put people on the rack and did all sorts of nasty things. That's Inquisition. And habeas corpus strikes at the heart of Inquisition, which is the foundation, ultimately, of the law of the city. Or where habeas corpus is, where it's practiced in its full force, torture is unknown. Torture is against the common law, by the way, always has been. And anybody who's dumb enough to engage in such things suffer the consequences. Any country that's dumb enough to engage in such things, as our country has, will suffer the consequences. Consequences to breaking true law are inevitable. The writ of habeas corpus is a jailed person's weapon, enabling handy challenge not only of the illegality of his imprisonment, but also of the lawlessness of the jailing power. By removing the state's power of intimidation through arbitrary jailing of an undefined length of time, the writ of habeas corpus strikes at the heart of tyranny. And only in extraordinary circumstances does our Constitution of the United States allow suspension, that means ignoring, of the writ of habeas corpus. And throughout our history, whether concerning slavery, war, or other matters, the writ of habeas corpus has been available and often used. Writing in the year 1833, I'm getting back to Justice Story, 1833, Justice Story recognized that only Congress has the power to suspend the writ of habeas corpus. And then he adds this, and I'm quoting Justice Story of the United States Supreme Court. He says, no suspension of the writ has ever been authorized by Congress since the Constitution was ratified. Now, he said that in 1833. By the time of the war between the northern and the southern tiers of the states, it had been suspended. And I can refer you to a case. If you go to the internet, you can look this case up and read it. It'll pop right to the top. The name of the case, it's a habeas corpus case that arose out of that terrible war about a man in Indiana who was saying things, criticizing the federal government. You think we've got it bad now. Now, it was bad then, too, and that was where it all began. He criticized the federal government. He was from Indiana. He was taken to Fort Harrison in Indianapolis, and he was tried and sentenced to hang right at the beginning of the war, 1861. Appealed to the United States Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court of the United States said, no. That's against the law. By placing the guarantee of habeas corpus in Article 1 of our Constitution, the framers put its suspension in the power of Congress alone, says Justice Story. And under our Constitution of the United States, says Justice Taney of the Supreme Court, only Congress has authority to suspend the writ of habeas corpus. I'll quote Justice Taney. He said this, as the powers given to Congress to suspend the writ of habeas corpus, the right to judge whether the exigency has arisen must exclusively belong to that of body. That means Congress. Chief Justice Marshall of the Supreme Court of the United States said that if suspending the writ of habeas corpus is necessary for public safety, only Congress has such authority. And Justice Taney concludes, I can add nothing to these clear and emphatic words of my great predecessor, speaking of Justice Marshall. So here's three fellows, Justice Taney, Justice Marshall, Justice Story, three of the most well-known justices of our Supreme Court, say Congress only has that power, no one else. Now, when Lincoln did suspend it, he had this information. But for some reason, he decided to ignore it. Keeping freedom demands watchfulness. As the decades and centuries roll on, legal labels will vary, and persons concerned will change, but the steady flame of ancient remedies for trespass upon God-given dignities in all men remains the same. Let me read that again. He who never quotes is never quoted. I'm quoting a fellow here. And in this case, I'm quoting yours truly. Now, let me read it again. Keeping freedom demands watchfulness. As the decades and centuries roll on, legal labels will vary and persons concerned will change. But the steady flame of ancient remedies for trespass upon God-given dignities in all men remains. It is a God-given dignity that you not be falsely imprisoned. Why? Because it mitigates against what God said. That's why. He said, be fruitful, multiply, and then he said, scatter. And we're all part of that scattering. The most fundamental created thing in all of God's revelation of his will to man is land. And the crowning of that creation and the caretaker of that land is Adam's race. That's us. And that's why he has given us this dignity. And we are to do all we can to stop evil men, evil governments, that means evil men, from trying to trespass upon the responsibilities that God has given directly to each of us. False imprisonment is a great matter. That's why our common law calls the writ of habeas corpus the great writ. This great writ, great, he calls it, says Tom Jefferson, secures every man here in America, whether alien or native freeman, against everything that is not law, whatever shape it may assume. Wow. Understood aright only in light of the common law, the habeas corpus clause thus applies in every geographic place the United States of America chooses to act, whether on the other side of the world or here. History is clear. Without this writ, freedom fails and the innocent will rot in filthy jails. I want to quote that whole, that was from a, well, that's a little poem. Kind of keeps things in perspective. It goes like this. All is lost when freedom fails. Good men rot in filthy jails. And them that cry, appease, appease, will be hung by the vermin they attempted to please. Trying to please evil men, especially when it comes to tyranny of government, is like feeding other people to an alligator hoping he'll eat you last. It's like feeding others to an alligator hoping he will eat you last. Well, that's a quote, too, from Winston Churchill, I believe. Oh, no, no, it's not bothering me. I'm not worried about it. Doesn't work that way. They'll get you. And then they'll eat each other. That's the way evil men do. Well, one more quote from Justice Joseph Story. Let me read this. Justice Story said, to understand the meaning of the habeas corpus clause, it will be necessary to have recourse to our common law. There it is. Let me read that again. This is Chief Justice Story of the United States Supreme Court, stressing the importance of our common law to inform our Constitution. To understand the meaning of the habeas corpus clause, it will be necessary to have recourse to the common law, for in no other way can we arrive at the true definition of habeas corpus. It is justly esteemed, he says, the bulwark of personal liberty, applied in every case of illegal restraint. For every restraint upon a man's liberty is, in the eyes of the law, and imprisonment. Every restraint. Listen to these words. He's a man that's thought this through. Surely. For every restraint upon a man's liberty is, in the eyes of the law, an imprisonment. Wherever may be the place or whatever may be the manner in which the restraint is affected. That's a beautiful quote. It shows the seamlessness, the seam, S-E-A-M, the seamlessness of this garment we call our common law. Illegal restraint, any illegal restraint, any restraint upon liberty, he says, is a false imprisonment. Well, thank you, John and Gerard. And I'm finished for today. Thank you for the opportunity, and back to you.
Okay, thank you, Brent. Appreciate it. Okay, we're going to move over to our queue. We've got one person in the queue. If anybody wants to get into the queue, star 6 to get into the queue. I believe it's star 6 and a 1. So we'll take a one and only caller at this moment in time. Let's see. LaRonda from Missouri. You got the mic. Go right ahead.
Okay. You ready?
Yep. Go right ahead.
Okay. I had a case filed in the federal court, had an attorney, and the demand was for a jury trial seeking $1 million for discrimination of race, sex, unequal pay, done with disparities, with a disparate impact and retaliation against a union and an employer that went to the appeals and the U.S. Supreme Court and all was denied. When I seen that my attorney was trying to sell me up a river, I then dismissed him and took the case as a pro se. This judge was even disallowing me after several requests to even dismiss my attorney until I stated how he must have accepted the fact that he is dismissed because he has released all of my case files to me. I even asked 5 times for the judge to recuse
himself. Let me ask you, let's go back because I'm not sure whether I got the first part of that. Are you saying that you actually won a case and now you can't collect?
No, I actually had a case. I was in the federal courts, went to the appeals in the U.S., and was denied at all points.
So what was the case about? You were suing somebody or something, a government?
A company and a union.
A company and a union. And you were suing them in federal court?
Yes.
Did they throw it out of federal court?
Yes, that's why I appealed and then went to the Supreme Court.
The problem you got is that that case, I can't see how that case would be a federal issue. It sounds like it's a state issue, and it should have been done in the state court. And I've seen this before where lawyers thought that they could go into a federal court with a case, and they can't. Look, the federal court will only hear cases for cause. Okay, that's the key word for cause. The question is what's the cause? Okay, well, it's anything under the Constitution. That's where they have the jurisdiction. You read about this in Article 3, Section 1. The judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts as the Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. The judges, both of the Supreme and Inferior Court, shall hold their offices in good behavior. But then it goes on in Section 2, and it says, the judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity, okay, arising under this Constitution. That's the key. So if it's an equity case, it has to arise under one of the 26 titles, 56 titles. There's 56 USC titles, and so they have to fall within that criteria in order for them to hear that case in equity. Now, in law, the only cases they can hear, and of course there's a little more, but it doesn't really affect you. It goes on, rising under the Constitution, the laws of the United States, the treaties made, which shall be made under their authority, all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, to all cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction, to controversies to which the United States shall be a party, controversies between two or more states, and I think that was some change in the amendment on that, and I don't recall exactly what it was. But there's nothing in here that defines you suing some kind of a corporation. That's got to be done in a state court, even though it may be a bank. And I think that's what you said. It was a bank, which I'll ask you in a
minute.
No,
I didn't. I said that it was against a union and a company, and I had an attorney, and he's the one who filed it.
How much did you give this lawyer?
Nothing, because I was in formal papis.
Okay, you were in the wrong court.
That's what the attorney did then. He filed it in the wrong court.
I've seen this before. Attorneys don't understand because a lot of the attorneys don't understand the Constitution. Now, if you had a person who's a common law lawyer who understands the Constitution, then that's a whole different ballgame. Now, you might get an attorney that claims himself to be a constitutional lawyer. I would presume he knows the Constitution. This lawyer apparently didn't know the Constitution, didn't understand that this is not the jurisdiction to sue in. Okay, so they acted appropriately. Okay, you could take this into the state court and sue there. Okay, that's where you sue. You can't sue in the federal court. Now, for cause for, let's say, on law, okay, that has to arise under the Constitution. And generally speaking, that brings us to our unalienable rights protected by this Constitution. Even though we have unalienable rights, for instance, you have the right to travel, that's an unalienable right, and if that's violated, you can take that into federal court for cause because it's an unalienable right, even though it's not mentioned in the Ten Amendments, you know, the first Ten Amendments. But anything falling under the first Ten Amendments definitely can be taken into court for cause. And they'll only hear that one issue. For instance, if you were suing a judge or something because they violated your unalienable right of due process, and you were suing the judge and maybe a prosecutor, or maybe some lawyers or something, or whatever the case may be, for conspiring and working together to violate your right of due process by carrying your way into jurisdictions unknown, let's say. Okay, now you could take that case into the court. Now, the original cause of that case might have been some kind of infraction or something. Maybe it's a criminal thing. They call it a criminal thing. Maybe it's some kind of an infraction. And it could include a fine or maybe imprisonment, and you're being tried there. That cannot be heard in the federal court, only the constitutional violation. And in the process of doing that, of course, you're going to talk about jurisdiction, and you're going to have that court shut down, cease and desist, because they don't have the authority, and you can work that way. But that's the problem with your case. You were in the wrong court.
Okay, well, can I continue? Because there's more that might change.
You're in Missouri?
Yes, sir.
Okay, you can go into the state court of Missouri there, your state court in your county.
Okay.
File it there. File your complaint there. You got to be careful. It's a civil case. You're going to get someone. They're going to make it equity. They're going to play with it. They're going to have a judge. You're going to have all these hearings, and it's going to go on and on and on. You got to really know how to handle this case. It's not going to be simple for you. You might want to try to find an attorney to handle the case that understands the particular, case that you have. That's the key thing. Some lawyers are out there, and some are really hungry sometimes, especially in the beginning, but some are hungry. Or maybe they have some problems and they can't keep their money, and they're hungry all the time. They take cases that they don't have any expertise in, when really they should say, well, let me pass you on to this individual because they are more understanding of that kind of a case than I would be. Unfortunately, some of these lawyers won't do that, and they'll take the case on and they'll blow it. I've been victim of that myself many years back, so I understand that clearly, these people. A lot of these lawyers are just in it for the money. They don't care about nothing.
Right.
But you can take it to court.
Yes, but can I continue? Because there's a bit more that might change what you just given me instructions to do. Okay.
Right. When you say continue, explain that. What do you mean, can you continue?
Continue reading what I was wanting to answer to.
Yeah. Go right ahead. I'm sorry. Sure.
Okay. When I seen that my attorney was trying to sell me up a river, I then dismissed him and took the case on as a pro se. This judge was even disallowing me after several requests to even dismiss my attorney until I stated how he must have accepted the fact that he is dismissed because he has released all of my files, case files to me. I even asked 5 times for the judge to recuse himself from the case, and each time he refused. There was a phone conference where even the transcript shows that the judge saying, it is I that decides what evidence is admitted. This judge even dismissed the sex from my case before the start of discovery. I have filed default judgment against the company for $1 million for failing to respond timely to the complaint, but approximately 2 years later, they did respond with a third-party interloper, and I filed a $1 million default judgment against the union for spoliation. The clerk made an entry for default judgment for $1 million against the defendants, and the judge denied it, stating that I had not proved that my case was valued at $1 million despite the fact that I had made a request five different times.
Hold on a second. Go back again and read the, you know, read that over again, that part. And I see that he made some kind of a ruling, and then another judge stepped in. Go back a little bit and reread that again.
I said that there was a phone conference where even the transcript show the judge saying, it is I that decides what evidence is admitted. This judge even dismissed the sex from my case before the start of discovery.
Yeah, but you're not going to get anywhere in this court. And I don't know why the judges are playing games with you the way they are. They're probably trying to protect the lawyer. They're trying to keep you out because they're going to. I think what they were ready to do was to throw you out for different purposes. But now they're in a cover up mode, in my opinion, to protect that lawyer. And I don't know why, but they do. You know, most of these judges. It's been my experience when you go into a federal court, and these lawyers that come in that have experience on the state level, but no experience on the federal level, and they make errors that. Like you and I would make because we don't have experience of the court, and they would really get hardball on these guys, and it's like they have disdain for them or something. I don't know. I've seen them in court on a few occasions. They'll be much more lenient on you and me as pro ses or in pro per, whatever you want to call it, in opposed to the lawyer who is supposed to have his quote unquote license. And he's bar trained, but apparently he's not trained in the federal courts. Again, he's stepping outside his abilities. So I don't know why these judges are taking this case the way you're reading it. It doesn't even make sense to me, but go ahead.
I know it don't, but that's because they're crooks, and I just needed to say this, sir.
Yeah, I think they're just covering up, want to throw you out and trying to kind of ease over the cover-up so you don't go sue your lawyer, because I would sue the lawyer.
Right. Okay, now, but like I said, the clerk made an entry for the default judgment for $1 million against
the
defendant.
Okay, the clerk made it because you did a default?
Yes.
You did an affidavit. So you did an affidavit of default, and the clerk signed off on it. And let me finish, sir. How much was that for again?
$1 million, okay, against
and
the defendant, and the judge denied it. The judge denied it, stating that I had not proved my case was valued at $1 million despite the fact that I made requests 5 different times for evidentiary hearing and was always denied and never granted. So how am I going to prove that my case is valued?
You're absolutely right. You know, they didn't give you your – again, they're not taking that case in. That's what it's really all about. You're not finding out the truth. Your lawyer bailed out and got the truth, and he knows what's going on, and now you're coming back in, and maybe the judge is protecting the lawyer. That's my opinion anyway. My question then is,
should this be a case that I join with NLA Joinder, or
no,
I go...
No. But listen to what I'm saying. We don't take that kind of case. We deal with the things, you know, serious problems as far as being, non-judicial foreclosures, habeas corpuses, getting people out of jail or disconnected from a court, jurisdictions of violation, so on. So you're suing someone for money, and that's a civil case. And you could still go after all these people. Now, if you want to learn how to do that, then you take our courses, because definitely inside our courses gives you the understanding of the process of how the court works and the structure of the court. It also, you'll get, we have what's called, I called an anatomy of a court case, which lays out the very beginning on how to file a case, what papers you need, you know, what's required. And if you do it according to the way they want to do it, you know, you fill out this cover sheet, and you pay the $310 or whatever it is in your state. It's usually, I know in New York it's $210, and then it's a $95 charge for getting your what's called an index number, and then $210 for judicial intervention. And I never request judicial intervention. The other side gets all upset with me because they want to move things along eventually too, and I keep pounding on them. And then they'll go in and pay I'll let them pay the $210. I don't care. They want the intervention. Go get it. I'm putting everything on the record. That's what I'm doing. Now, the problem is when you go in there, you're now going up to the judge and saying, okay, I'm going to allow you to make the decision. Now, unless he knows the people you're going after, if it's corporation, it's a big corporation, you know, he's going to try to maintain status quo and protect them, probably, not necessarily so. But probably, maybe if you're going up against a lawyer, they're probably going to protect them, and they're going to play all kinds of games with you. And you really got to know what's going on and be able to see this happening. And that takes two things: it takes knowledge and experience. Okay,
right.
You have to get the knowledge. The knowledge you can get from our website by going through our course to begin with, reading the books that we've laid out, and seeing how to file a case and necessary paperwork. There's also a jurisdictionary course you could take.
I am with Jurisdictionary. I've been with them since 2008 when they had CDs and DVDs, and I bought them and taught from them for 5 months.
Okay, so you have some basic understanding then. You have some. If you've really worked hard at that, you have a lot of understanding of how that works.
Okay. Well, I needed to know if this was a joinder case, and if not, I plan to pursue as a fraud upon the court while acting under the color of law against them in their own individual personal capacity. So now I know what I need to do.
Right. Yeah, we wouldn't take on the a personal lawsuit type case, and we're dealing with people that are in trouble, that the government or someone's coming in, taking everything they own from them and beating them up, or they're in jail and they don't belong there, all that kind of stuff. But, yeah, those kind of cases we don't do. But, we can give you some thoughts and ideas as you build your case and put things together, you know.
Okay, well, keep that in mind. Because I may need some assistance in regards to. And then I did submit two questions to Carl, but they might have came in, you know, just before the show that he didn't answer, but I didn't ask. So can I try to ask him right quick?
Sure, right, because there's only a couple of people in the queue right now, so go right ahead.
Okay. I had created and presented flyers suggesting that NLA put online for those to make copies and to distribute within their communities and elsewhere with info about the administrators of the county grand jury position. Do y'all plan to create such a flyer?
Yeah, say that again, because I'm not sure I understand.
Do y'all plan to create a flyer for us to distribute within our community about the administrator of the county grand jury positions?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we do have some flyers, and we'll try to create flyers that people come up with ideas about. So if you kind of you take a look, you can get a hold of Jan at nationallibertyalliance.org, and I'm sure you could probably find some flyers that we have up there. You could take a look at that. If you have some ideas of some things that we might want to put together, which sounds like you do, you know,
well,
just
I did, but I didn't get a response.
Well, jot them down with bullet points, get it to Jan, and then I'll quiz Jan on it in a couple of days to see if you sent anything to him, okay?
And then one other question. Okay,
Who did you send it to? Do you remember?
Probably Jan, but we're talking probably a year ago or less,
okay.
Sometime ago. And then I had another question that's like, let's say in this county that I live in, that we have four peoples that signed up, that they met all the requirements, took all the courses for the county grand jury administrator of the county grand jury position.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Do we, okay, so what would be, what would happen then once we get the four, or do we need to wait? Will we have to wait till all the counties throughout all the states get their people's, you know?
We need only win in the federal court. That opens up the entire nation. Okay, and because we the timing of what we're doing and how we're filing it and what we have done in the past and what we're going to do in the next 30 days or so, that with the timing of what's happening in Washington right now, you know, indictments are ready to roll. There's all kinds of talk out there. They're revealing a lot of stuff. Anybody paying attention? I would suggest to get really informed. We've got some places on our website that we refer people out that they might want to go to listen to the real news and get really informed. There's one X22 that we refer people to, and they come out with a report every day, maybe 50 minutes, 40 minutes, and sometimes twice a day, and then they do interviews that are very, very rewarding and gives us a lot of information with specialized individuals. So X22 is probably one of the best places to become very much informed on what's going on in Washington, what's going on with the case, what Q is saying, the revealing of all the criminal activities by the higher-ups in the Democratic Party going all the way up to the top. All that's being revealed and being talked about right now. It's spilling out into Fox News and is even starting to get over into the fake news. And some of the fake news is starting to report some of this stuff real. I guess they're getting nervous. And so all of that is happening right now, and that puts us in a prime position. Okay? So, yeah, we could break open and start to enter into the courts by the end of this year. That's a really, really extremely strong possibility. And I think that's where it's going to that's how it's going to happen. But, you know, you never know exactly what's going to happen, how it's going to work. It should be a slam dunk case for us. When we write the case, and we are writing it right now, it's going to be a really powerful slam dunk case, I think. Everything in there is pretty much almost self-evident, okay, because it's backed with sources that cannot be argued against, the United States Supreme Court decisions, Founding Fathers' words, the Federalist Papers, you know, all things in history, common law, you know, how common law came to be. United States versus Williams is one strong case that gives us a huge amount of information and power and authority of the grand jury. And of course, we're looking for four people to take on that job in every single county. It's four people to become the administrators for the grand jury. We are training them. We will writing a handbook for them. We will assist them with information. You know, whenever they have questions, they can come on and ask us. They can ask through mail, email, or they can do it on Monday nights, or we can even have special meetings sometimes for the matter of fact, we probably will have special meetings for the administrators once they start to get access into the courts and take control. What people have to realize and how powerful this really is think about this, okay? Just think about this. We the people never gave any authority to our government to make any law or try to control our behavior whatsoever. And any state that tries to take that power and authority would be beat up very, very easily by the Bill of Rights because they don't have the power or the authority. Common law, okay, is a law is a court of the people. Elected individuals cannot participate; they can only administrate. That's why you get what's called a magistrate. A judge is not only a judge; he also is a magistrate. He or she is a magistrate if he or she is sitting in a court of law, which means he administrates the court process. He keeps things moving along. He makes sure he records the will of the jury and also puts out the order for, you know, executing whatever decisions, enforcement, and so on. But they can't make any decisions. It is the court, which is the people, you know, the jury. They get to decide the law and the facts. They also get to decide with an eye on restitution, because every injury must have a remedy. That's a common law maxim, self-evident. Every injury must have a remedy. That's justice. That's righteousness. That's right. You can't argue that. So therefore, They have to make sure there's a remedy for the individual. And jail is not the answer and the solution to problems and even crimes to some degree. Unless it's violent, maybe, then, of course, the jury can do what it pleases. But, you know, a well-educated jury understanding at the end of the day they got to consider mercy. They're really there representing God. He's the king of the court. This is God's court. It's not the government's court. And the people rule that court as what's called the king's bench. That's the jury. And they rule from the heart. You know, God said he wrote his laws into the hearts of men. And at least in the New Testament era, that is the claim he said. And so we have to understand how all that works. But that's the power and that's the authority. And that's where the authority of a court comes from.
Okay, then. Well, thanks for your great response. You have a good day.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Bye.
Okay, we'll take our next caller. Anybody wants to get into the Q*6? Next question. Someone with an 805 area code.
Hello, John.
Hey, how you doing? Who?
Yeah, we spoke last week. Brian.
Oh, okay, Brian. What state are you from, by the way?
California.
Brian from California. Okay.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. We spoke last week about garnishment from the California Tax Franchise Board. And
okay.
I just want to thank you very much for posting your notice and demand. It's very much appreciated.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I got that up there. I just recently got it up over the weekend. I couldn't get it up quick enough, but I did get it up this weekend. It's a pretty good notice and demand. I've worked off of Bill Thornton's paperwork, but we really enhanced it quite a bit, I think, and we've laid out the things pretty clearly in there and gave you a lot of meat inside that. So hopefully it'll do you well.
That's great. Yes, I've actually been using it with Bill Thornton's because he makes a lot of points that are really pertinent
mm-hmm.
to my situation.
Yeah, I think he said there's 8 points that have to be met, and we followed that strategy.
Excellent. Okay, so on your instructions, it says proof of service that constructive notice should be served upon the adversary in the same manner that one would serve a summons in a lawsuit.
Absolutely. They have a duty to answer and respond, okay? And if you serve it properly as if it would be done in a court, you know, remember, look at, if you were filing a court case, you start to build your case, and the first order of business is opening up a file in the court, okay? You're not looking for a judge right now. You're in the middle of an argument and a dispute between another individual, and hopefully you can take care of it in that dispute, and you're creating a record. And that's what papers going back and forth is all about. The lawyers love to get, RJI written in there. As a matter of fact, on the federal level, it's automatic. It's one price brings in the request for judicial intervention, which is called an RJI, and also gives you the case number or court number. In New York, it's called an index number. And so you get that number. But the number itself costs $95, and you can file it in the courts and get it moving. But you can do this outside the court, gather all your evidence, maintain all your paperwork, get a good dialogue going, even if it's one way. If they acquiesce, they default, let them know. And then, you know, at some point in time, you could take all your paperwork, all your evidence, all your conversation, all your paperwork, and file it into the court with a show cause on why a judgment shouldn't be taken, show cause why a judgment shouldn't be had against them for, and get your nice good wherefore clause, create all your nice paperwork, which, again, we offer a lot of information on how to do that. And then you should be able to really move through the court quite quickly. They've already acquiesced. Now let's see if they're going to answer in the court, too. And, you know, the judge should not really allow them to answer. You should be able to get a rightful, righteous summary judgment. As long as you prove the fact that they got your paperwork, that's why you want to serve it as if you're serving in a court of law.
So that means I need to hire a service or have the sheriff?
Well, you can you could do it. What you do is you get a friend or somebody who's not part of the case, okay, and you put everything in your certified returned slip in the mail, certified return, and have that person drop it in the mail, certified. You know, you go to the post office with them, make sure it's done right, get it in there. And then you take them up to the bank or someplace where you can find a notary, and you fill out what's called an affidavit of service. You'll find that among the list of things in most of our paperwork. You find it under jurisdictional challenge. You find it there. I know that.
Okay, so then I have, once I have that, I just keep that for my records if it does move into court.
You're right, and you know your court case is really over. I know I would be taking the position the court case is over. If they tried to make an argument, I would object to the whole process. I would try to, I'd try to go through the judge. I'd open up a court of record, but still focus in for a summary judgment, which is righteous in this case because they acquiesced. And so you're just really going through the administrative changes to get the process done. Whether you're going to get, who are you suing? Is it an individual, a corporation, or government? Or who are you suing? Or who are you interested in making your argument with?
California Franchise Tax Board.
Okay, so you're going to be dealing with a judge that's going to want to maintain, the status quo. It's going to be a problem. It's not that you can lose, but it's a problem. But absolutely, look it, you make the point. This is where it helps to read our paperwork because there's so much stuff there. I also put up there, I got over 400 footnotes. When I started writing papers, I started collecting footnotes, and I'd give it a name, the main name of what it was, and then put my footnotes into notepads. And I created over 400 of them, and that's up there. You can go up to that page we're talking about, and you can download those footnotes. But look at, they had a duty to answer. Now, the California who?
Franchise Tax Board.
Okay, so it's a government agency of some kind.
It's the tax agency. It's basically the income tax of the state.
Okay, all right. So they are it's underneath the authority of the state, and they're going to try to give you some baloney that you first got to take it into the lower courts and work your way up and all that stuff. And you deny it. You let them know you're one of the people to support a record, and you deny that, and you move on. You want to make in there, there's some United States Supreme Court rulings, and one particular that comes to mind, which says that when someone has a duty to speak and they remain silent, okay, that's fraud. Okay, that's what the United States Supreme Court had said on a couple occasions, by the way. So you want to find at least one or more of those kind of Supreme Court rulings to make your case. So you're actually at the point they have defrauded you by not answering you. They had a duty to answer you, okay, and they didn't. So therefore, and then they acquiesced. They defaulted, and you file your default at some point. You got to file a default, okay, with them in your process, okay. So you have all that collected. Now you go open your case and you take it into the court for a collection, really show cause why collection shouldn't take place. I mean, I wouldn't word it that way, but you think about it, show cause why a judgment shouldn't be taken a place against X, Y, Z, and so on and so forth.
Okay, so the notice that they sent me that they're going to start garnishing doesn't have a name of an agent. So your instructions were just, go after the top dog or find the administrative judge or something.
Right, whoever is the top dog. Right, you will find people. In government, you can trace right up the line. It starts from an elected individual who may appoint individuals, okay? And those people, so you want to trace it right up the line. So the appointed person for that particular agency, state agency, is the person you want to go after. And if there's any names of any individuals that's threatening you with the paperwork that you're responding to, and you got to copy all of them now. Remember, you don't just copy one; you get them all, and you're expecting all of them to respond. So you got to build your case up.
Okay, so I have like the state controller, the chair of the State Board of Equalization. These are the top people, and I've got
if they're all part of the process up the line, you can do them all, right? But you don't go outside of the line of of people. And remember, you can't go after anyone that you haven't notified, giving them a notice and demand. So if you think of two people, maybe there's somebody who's in charge, and then above that person may be a commissioner or some other appointed position of some kind that runs that agency or whatever it is. So you can go after those two individuals. If there's an agent in itself that's coming and buzzing you up with all kinds of problems, trying to collect, and all that. You can add those individuals too, you know?
So would it be good for, like, say, maybe like the management of the accounts receivable and also the management of the collection services?
I wouldn't get too involved. Go directly to the people you're talking to that have the authority to fix the problem. Don't go after the little person. Go after the big Jesus, the people who are at fault, the people who make the rules and run the game. Go after the highest, supervisory level. Then that's who you're going to be talking to about this problem. And also you're going to want to find that commission. If you can go to, or whoever that appointed person is, you want to go directly to that person if possible. And of course, the supervisory person that's working the case and causing the havoc and the problem. And if you do the notice and demand on both of them, okay, in a proper fashion, and they don't respond and do the right thing, then you got them.
Okay, and then I imagine that each one of them needs to receive a notarized original, correct?
You mean as far as the affidavit of service?
As far as the notice and demand, should I...
Notice and demand, you do want to take... why not give them an original? Give them a good document. But it doesn't matter. Even if you give them a copied document, the bottom line is you can produce the original. But why not?
I meant with original with a notary stamp on each one of them, or can it be copied? Because it has the place for notary on your instructions here.
Yes, absolutely. What I usually do, if I'm serving three or four people, I will make three or four forms plus a form for myself and take it and get four or five copies notarized all in one shot and give them originals. I like to do original stuff. Okay, but, you know, again, you can probably if you want to, you know, you're going up against the beast. Do everything in perfection. Get them originals.
Sure. Okay.
And documentation and any information you have, you can file as evidence and, you know, mark your exhibits and add it on, but maintain the originals yourself that you can produce if you had to produce it in a court, if they challenged it.
Okay, great. And the instructions I had from you last week, it says, pretty much I should expect them to default. And then you said, right away, move for a decision. Do you mean to move for enforcement or move for a decision? Is that something different?
Well, I don't remember saying decision, but move for a default. Look at, you send the papers to them. You'll get a card back. It'll be the card. The date will be on there that they received it. So you don't count that day, and you add 30 days, and it's the day after that. So it's 32 days away from the time that the card date, let's say. And that's when you go and move for a notice of default.
Okay, great. And on another subject about affidavits, do they need to be notarized to carry any kind of weight, or is a perjury?
Any affidavit that unnotarized is not an affidavit. An affidavit means it's a sworn statement. That's an affidavit.
Okay, and it doesn't mean the perjury statement?
It must be witnessed by someone of a certain authority, a magistrate, notary, and so on, a judge. You know, they can all do it.
Oh, so it does need to be notarized.
It needs to be notarized. Without being notarized, it's worthless.
Got it.
Again, you can't open a case without an affidavit. And that's what they do all the time. You can beat them on that if you can get a judge that will obey the law.
Sure. Okay. I don't know what your queue looks like. I have a couple of other questions. They're not on topic.
Get into the queue. We'll pick you up. I only got two other people, but I want to pick them up. But let's go to the next person, and you can click the *6 again and get back in.
Great.
Okay?
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay, let's take our next caller. We got Greg Atkins. How you doing, Greg? You got the mic.
All right. How you guys doing tonight?
Good.
Listen, I know this is going to seem like an odd question to you, okay, but I'm quite serious and I know what's going on at my end and what's been done. Would any of you know anything about how to have it verified, confirmed in a concrete way that can be used as evidence in court that the local authorities have tapped your phone, because they tapped mine quite a while ago.
And you're absolutely sure they did that?
I am. And now let me tell you, John, I understand how rare, how uncommon that is for somebody to say.
I don't deny it. I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of people that I know.
I've never met anyone, talked to anyone who thought that that happened to them. But I will say that a few people that I've talked to in helping me with my case here in Redford, Michigan, they eventually came to agree as well that they think my phone is tapped as well, because some strange occurrences happened after some phone conversations we had about my case regarding what the judge and the prosecutor did.
If you can go and start documenting those things, and you have enough documented evidence to build up to prove it, okay, the next step after that is to go down and find out if there has been a warrant taken out to tap your phone.
Well, that's what I mean. I have no idea, and nobody I talk to here knows anything about how can I try to prove it. I mean, it's not like you just call.
Well, again, that is difficult to prove, so I don't know that you're going to be able to prove it. But here's the thing. It is tapped, okay? And you can prove that it's tapped, and they don't have a warrant to do that. Boy, they got a problem. Okay, so
the big thing is,
if you can document things that happened that could not have happened or should not have happened unless, you know, someone was listening to your calls, and you can do numerous of those things, I'm sure that could build up as some kind of an evidence. The next thing to do is to go down and discover whether there is a warrant out. I'm not sure exactly how you might do that. I don't know if Brent's listening in. Maybe he knows, and he can pipe in on this.
Well, I would check with who about that?
Well, look, I know at a federal level, any warrant that's taken out has to be registered up in the federal district court within the district, okay? That's on the federal level. On the state level, it's got to be the same thing within the county. So it's got to be someplace. But law enforcement is the ones that have to do that, and they have to, you know, have that warrant. They got to have a sworn affidavit
If they have that, it's nothing I was ever informed. And listen, it's a local detective that put the tap on my phone. He's head of the detective department.
Put the tap on your phone? You know, what's his? What do you think his purpose is?
Oh, I know exactly. I know very specifically. This was done a few years ago. This is how corrupt this town, Redford, Michigan, is. Years ago, a woman moved in across the street from me that opened up a drug dealership out of her house immediately. She's still going 11, 12 years later. She deals heroin. She's probably one of the biggest heroin dealers in this township. I complained numerous times about the activity going on to the local police. They were never interested, okay?
So you think she's being protected?
Yes, and a neighbor down the street eventually told me, well, she brags about being friends with Detective so-and-so and says he's not going to let anything happen to her.
All this is evidence. You want to document all
this.
Well,
the neighbor's not going to cooperate. Everybody around here is scared, but you see,
I would have a recorder if I was in these situations, and I'd be recording everything. As long as you're part of the conversation, it's lawful to record.
Well, there
are two states, I think, or maybe three, that does not permit it, but you can Google that to find out what states they are. And that doesn't mean you still can't do it, though. You know, you're going into a court of law, you're coming into a common law court, you're part of the conversation, you can record. You can't record a conversation if you're not part of it.
I think I can do it here in Michigan. But the thing is, because of that reason, they had my phone tapped a few years ago. And now when I got into this case with the ordinance officers coming after me at the direction of his boss, whose big pay raise I complained about and things I spoke about at the public township trustees meetings, and they finally decided to go after me using the building department to citation me. What eventually happened was the detective told the court and the judge and the prosecutor, oh, hey, well, I got his phone tapped. You can listen to who he's discussing with his case with,
now,
trying to help.
He said that, and are there witnesses to him saying that?
No, no, no. I know this is what happened. Look, I'm linking how the court people, who knew nothing, you know, about me complaining about this drug dealer, at least not initially, how they ended up having access to my phone conversations. They got it from this crooked detective that had it even 2 or 3 years earlier before they started after me with all the ordinance violations and dragging me in and out of court about that. They conveniently got the access to my phone from the detective, and they've been using it to listen to me talk with people about how to deal with my case. This has been going on for more than a year now.
Is this what police force or what police agency
Redford Township,
does
this detective work for? Redford
okay.
Township.
So you know who you talk to? You go talk to the sheriff. Do you know the sheriff? Is he any good?
He's controversial. This is Detroit here.
Oh, yeah, you do have a problem in Detroit, like being in New York. Detroit may be a little more worse.
Well, let me tell you, you know how the detective ended up tapping my phone? Because they were doing nothing about
Wait
this drug
second.
Dealer.
What county are you in?
Wayne County, Michigan. Probably one of the most corrupt counties in the United States.
You don't know the name of your sheriff, do you?
Yeah, if I can think of it.
Meanwhile, while we're talking, maybe someone out there can Google the Wayne County sheriff. Michigan. All right, well, anyway, that's where I would go to try to talk. You see, my sheriff is pretty decent. He's been hiding for a long time, but he's come out of the closet. And he's gone up against the governor and everybody here in this state, you know, who wants to go after people with weapons, and they wanted to take over the permits and all that. And he told them where they can go, and he's fighting them tooth and nail. And I went and talked with him, and he said he'd come out anytime, in certain situations and questions I asked him. So he was very cooperative with me. You might be able to go sit down with your sheriff and talk with him, and maybe he'll be cooperative. But you want to bring up some evidence. You don't want to feel that he thinks you're some kind of wacko thinking this.
I don't really have concrete evidence. But I know it's happening. It's Benny Napoleon here in Wayne County, Michigan.
Okay, yeah, I never heard of him. So.
Okay. Well, look, the thing is, the detective got tipped off when I started calling entities like the Michigan State Police, the Wayne County Sheriff's, the Detroit FBI office, and their narcotics divisions and all that, because nothing was being done by the Redford Police. Somebody that I talked to there they knew this detective here, and they told him this guy is complaining about this drug dealer.
Well, a couple of things, though. Look, I'm sure you know you're playing on dangerous grounds here. You know, when you're dealing with drugs and if there's a dirty cop protecting them, you know, you're really playing with fire there. So I'd be very careful. But I really can't offer you any more than I've offered you, no matter how much of the story, and I'm sure there's a lot more to the story, but the only thing you could do is try to build a case and then work it from there. If you think you have enough evidence, then you go and find out if there is
a warrant. But I want to know who can tell me if there's been a tap on the phone, Freedom of Information Act thing.
I will tell you. Look at you. You want to gather as much evidence as you can, even though it's not direct evidence, but enough bringing together to get something going that you can convince the sheriff, and then bring it to the sheriff and talk with him about it and see if he can't discover whether there actually is a warrant on you for some reason or another, which you should tell him, of course, there shouldn't be. But if my phone is tapped and there's no warrant, I'd like to know that there's no warrant.
When you say warrant, you mean court order for the phone tapping.
Right. They can't come out without a warrant to tap your phone.
Well, see, I also suspect, I've come to suspect for other reasons that would take me a while to explain, but I suspect that this judge, one of the two that's been after me here in Redford, the head judge, Karen Khalil, and she's the one that put David Scheid here in Michigan in jail illicitly for a month years ago, same judge that's been on me. I think she's in this drug dealing thing.
I can't say one way or the other, but if that is the case, again, you know you're playing on dangerous ground.
Yeah, I know it.
Why don't you deliver the information concerning this kind of stuff to the sheriff and see what he does with it? One of two things is the problem. Either he's corrupt too, or they're so powerful there that the sheriff fears them. I mean, those are the two possibilities. If there indeed is a problem and he doesn't do anything. So, and I don't know what that would be, but I don't know how much, I can't offer you anything more than I just said. So, in this case.
Well, the way things operate around here, it's not unlikely that this sheriff would simply contact them, say, hey, this guy here is saying that you've got his phone tapped and it started over you trying to bust a drug dealer and then they'll say oh no, that's crazy, nothing like that's going on. And where does that leave me with them?
Well, yeah, again, that's what I'm saying, you're playing with fire.
I was just wondering if there's a system, if there's a way you can subpoena with phone companies or what to find out if there's been an order for a tap on your phone.
Well, if there is a proper warrant, the phone companies wouldn't be able to reveal that to you. They're not going to be able to do that. That would be a crime for them. So you're stuck between a rock and a hard place. I don't know. Just be careful. And try to figure out how important this is. Look, you're in a very highly corrupted area where there's a lot of drugs and a lot of bad stuff going on there. And you got to question yourself, how much involved? Hey, I can go down to New York City. I was born and raised in New York City. I lived there until I went into the service. So, you know, that's where I come from. And there's a lot of crime, a lot of stuff going down there. But, you know, and I'm way out of time for that because I've been out of there many, many years. But if I knew things were going on down, I don't know that I'd want to go down to get involved. It's so dangerous. I mean, they got videos of cops trying to shoot witnesses, and then they set them up and they arrested this individual that they tried to kill. These are cops down in New York City in Manhattan, and they tried to kill this guy, and it was all videotaped. They didn't know it. And he turned the whole thing around, but not one of those cops went to jail. And it was attempted murder.
Right.
And if it wasn't for other cops coming onto the scene at the time, he wouldn't have been arrested. He would have been dead.
Well, so, there are people around this township that are very afraid of these authorities and don't want to get involved. And I know a couple people that have been forced to move out of the town, and some of them were very good people
protested. If you really want to do something, the only way you're going to change these things is to get a just court going. And that's what we're trying to do. That's our goal on a national level right here at National Liberty Alliance, is to get a just court everywhere. We'll turn the federal courts just, and they can only be just when the people are in charge of their courts. Remember, their administrative courts or their equity courts, we don't care about them. I mean, that's all, you know, working and monitoring and policing themselves, and those they're controlled by regulations and codes and statutes and so on and so forth, but the people are not. So we need to bring back justice so the people rule, and then once your people are ruling, now we can go deal with all that problem. You know, because look at your county will be as just as your court is. Okay, and that's the bottom line on that. And our nation will be as just as the federal courts are. If we don't have just court, and then therefore the people who work for us, you know, the people we elect and the people they appoint will be as just as our court system. Because if you get the court system back under the authority of the king of the court, which is God, and justice is going to prevail and people are pressing that forward and doing the right thing, and we're trying to create this in such a way that people do the right thing. But, you know, we got a lot of ideas and plans on how this might work. But anyway, once you can get justice in the court, now you'll have justice in the land. That's just the way it is.
these two corrupt judges that have been on the bench in this town's court, the 17th District Court, have both been on the bench for more than 30 years. They've both been up for, or at least more than 20, probably closer to 30. They've both been up for re-election three times each, about every 6 years. The past 20 years I've been here, they've never had an opposing candidate on the ballot against them. Each of them has run unchallenged every time, three times over 20 years. They could have voted for themselves and won. Why is that? How did that happen?
Yeah, again, look at we know the whole system is corrupt. Look at, again, if you want to know how corrupt your neighborhood is, go see how corrupt your court is, and you'll know how corrupt everything else is. And believe me, courts across America are corrupt everywhere. You know, we're probably worse than a lot of other third world nations that have all this corruption and pay off. You know, we got the mafia on steroids, so to speak, in running our nation. And the president is exposing it. You see, it's from the highest level, and it comes all the way down, all these people. You know, these judges, they're maintaining the status quo. You know, how does a judge make less than $150,000? That's top dollar, $150,000. But how does a judge make less than $150,000 and retire as a millionaire? How does he do that? How does that happen? You know, something's going on here. And go into the family courts. You want to find out how corrupt these things are. Go into the family courts alone. I mean, and sit down and listen.
I know some people in there that have been involved with that.
Yeah, you're not going to get into the family court. That's closed.
And in my case, they've yanked me into court about 8 times over the past year or so, and all but twice they held me till last to empty the courtroom out so there were no witnesses to see how they were dealing with me. They did it over and over and over.
Sometimes they're afraid what you might say and other people might pick up on it. We've had that done to, you know,
It's afraid that other people are going to see how wrongfully they're treating me is the main thing. Then they would falsify the transcripts they wrote to cover up anything that the judge said that would incriminate her later if it were revealed. They did that over and over. Anyway.
All right. I can offer you much more, and we do have other people in the queue.
Yeah, I understand. I'll see if I can check with the county. I'll have to think if I want to do that, contact the sheriff.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, unless there's a really, real strong reason you have to do it, you know, you're not going to go and clean up the neighborhood and maybe thinking, well, I'm doing the right thing.
Trying to sue these people, and that if I could prove that, that would certainly help.
Yeah, well, that's going to be even more dangerous for you. You know, you better be careful. That's all I can tell you. I mean, I understand going out on the limb to do the right thing and to do the godly thing and so on and so forth. But you have to take account of what's going on, you know, and see what's going on and realize, well, in this situation, it's a lose-lose situation and you're not going to accomplish nothing. So what's another way to do it? You look for another way to do it. Well, make your court just again. How do you do that? Work with National Liberty Alliance to make all our courts just again. Starts on the federal level. Once we win on the federal level, it just in one district, it works in all the districts. The law is the law. The decision is decision. The authority is the authority. It's done. Now, as far as the states trying to keep us out, they can't do that because we move into the federal court where we got the ruling and we can close them down. People have every right to run their own courts because that's what natural law is. But with that, I got to move to the next.
All right. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All righty. Okay, let's go to the next caller. We got a few people still in the queue. We got Dan. So if anybody wants to get into the queue, *6. Go ahead, Dan.
Yes, sir. Good evening to everyone. And as always, it's always good to be able to sit back and enjoy and listen and learn. The main reason why I'm in the queue is a reminder to, I've been so busy myself, but I want to remind a lot of other people very soon. You guys will be providing us with paperwork, and this is to be sent certified according to your instructions out to municipalities, I guess you would say, more into the counties, the county seats, the possible judges, or at least the clerk of courts, sheriffs, et cetera, whatever exposure that we can get. And I wanted to remind everybody that we need to, I for one need to send in. I've been so busy, but I've had trouble with my computer and stuff and emails and stuff. I need to send in to Jan that I'm, you know, volunteering, and of course we'll forego some funds to send it out according to you guys' blessings to whatever entities we need to do. 3,133 counties. I guess I'll leave it to you as to exactly who we might need to be top priority as to send out and when you guys get ready.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, get a hold of Jen. I presume what you're talking about is putting out to certain, to governors or legislators a copy of the papers we're going to be filing. Is that what you're
exactly
talking about? Right.
Exactly.
And we want to start off with a list starting from the federal level of all 94 federal district courts and then work our way down to the governors. And then when we do the governor, we could probably do the legislators at the same time. But we'll have to figure that out. But, yeah, talk with Jan. And we hope that a lot of people get involved and volunteer their time just to print one out and send one in to somebody that will tell you who to send it to. And this way we can get more out there.
For North Carolina, not to be lengthy here, there might be someone else and in the queue, but for North Carolina, I have a special individual that's involved with legislations. He's actually one of the House of Representatives that I know that would be good to get it to the legislators. The Attorney General and the governor of North Carolina, I'm not sure they're, I won't say any further, but most definitely.
The main thing is to make everyone aware that's in power and authority of this paperwork, and hopefully they'll read it and learn the law and decide to obey it, because we're coming out after them too eventually. And they should realize that. So. And so all they have to do is be obedient to the law. Hey, look, we're coming out there with the olive branch, and we're not looking to beat anyone up. If they decide all the evil or whatever they've been doing, and they decide to start doing the right thing, we're not going to chase them down. But, of course, you know, if they've injured somebody and someone brings them before the grand jury for an injury, that's a problem we can't correct.
I really have, you know, of course we've spoken before and about this. I'm very convinced that the sheriff is in each and every one of these counties probably, since he's a high elected officer and what his job is there, and in relationship to the courts and the due process of what he does in carrying out law, when in fact is not quite yet being carried out for the people out here that are wanting justice through our regular common law courts and jury trials. That is, of course, predicated to hopefully at some point have that process be so denoted and impregnated into a sheriff's mind. It seems to me what I'm trying to say is foremost importance would be to get these notices out to our sheriffs, and then we could also work with, if we know some of those county municipal, like I know some of the managers of the counties and the county commissioners. They absolutely get notice from the Chapel Hill School of Government in North Carolina as to the existing laws that have come from the legislators. It goes straight to those county commissioners and the county managers and so forth and county attorney. To me, I believe we would spend our nickel very wisely if we could get a lot of our guys and ladies and so forth, to have the documents you want us to send, but yet get it to direct to the sheriff and those that fall in line that I just spoke of, my opinion, right? And don't get me wrong.
If we can get one person in every county to take care of the business of that county, which may be two or three papers, and maybe we get a few people working together, and it becomes practically nothing to do to get it out.
I'll be glad to, again, and I need to send Jan, because Jan needs a notice in with my intent, and everybody else is. And that's one reason why I called in tonight. We all need to put our intent in writing and wait on you guys, and you guys tell us exactly what we, you know, the documents that you're wanting to send out. And I'll do my best to get the job done to maybe a couple of counties, Brunswick County especially, and New Hanover County, and I might even be able to do a few surrounding. But anyway, I'll forego the expense at least a couple of those counties and get it to some of those officials.
Okay, appreciate it. And anybody else who could volunteer for this, now is the time to get a hold of Jan, get on the list, so when we start filing these papers, hopefully the people will be able to deliver one or two on their own, so that, you know, because we can't get it out to all the people, you know, that we'd like to get a copy to. And we definitely would like to get, you know, again, the sheriffs, the governors, and the legislators at a bare minimum. And, of course, first and foremost, the 94 federal district courts, to all of the federal district courts. And of course, also, we'd like to get it to every state court within, you know, the county, every county judge, not a county judge, but a state judge in a county, the state court in every county in America, except for the very, very, very extremely rural counties. Other than that, you know, there's a state court. But go ahead.
A second little memo, and I don't want you to, you know, be too lengthy at all or hold you here. There might be some others that still want to say something. There is a situation in with my parents' estate, my grandfather's estate, whole island, 832 acres, and my father, who had, gosh, served this nation in several wars and World War II right on, just commendable service. And this situation was that my father paid off complete all the mortgage on this 832 acres, and I am considering possibly to do a common law trust for that area, and it'll be I've got the idea of two towns that could be under a marine setting, because we've got a lot of islands, and we've got a lot of salt, brackish waters and sea waters around that need to be protected. I'm considering a common law trust for two marine towns, and which will have to be named, and one will be Sea Islands, North Carolina, S-T-A-T-E, little state, and then Sea Islands, South Carolina, little S-T-A-T-E, and put them on a notice on the Calabash River Bridge that comes over on the island from the mainland here and around the Calabash, North Carolina. And with that, I'm considering making the people that are already inhabited with own lots within that boundary work out something with them. They are basically there and didn't realize on those properties, thinking that there's, you know, 100% title. And so I've thought about this and prayed about this for a long time, and I just wanted to bring this up to you because we were talking about it the last time, and I do need to close here, and because there could be some other people, about the common law trust, what I wanted to do possibly if it didn't interfere with the reverse mortgage idea. So I'll leave that with you. I know you're so busy. And
and I will be posting up on our page, you know, where we have all this information underneath, what is it called, due process. We'll post up how to form a common law trust and how to open a bank account. So
I believe you said in the past, and I don't know whether you still do, but might have an example of the common law trust that you might.
It's pretty simple to follow the procedure.
Okay.
I can probably create
you know, something of one I've already done already and give you a decent look at how one looks. But it's in it's not the top of my priority, but it is something I want to get to because people have asked. Okay, let me go on to the next caller. I appreciate it.
Very good. Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Okay, next caller. We only got two people in the queue. It's 11:30. We could take a couple more maybe, but let's take the next two anyway. Next caller is California Fred. How you doing, California Fred?
Hello, John. Good to talk to you again, buddy.
Same. Thanks.
I came on to tell you something. It's an update. It's a notice. 2 hours ago, President Trump tweeted, "Next week, ICE will begin the process of removing the millions of illegal aliens who have illicitly found their way into the United States. They will be removed as fast as they come in."
All right.
Mexico, using their strong immigration laws, is doing a very good job of stopping people. The second part of the tweet is, you know, it can only go 120 characters. "Long before they get to our southern border, Guatemala is getting ready to sign a safe third agreement. The only ones who won't do anything are the Democrats in Congress. They must vote to get rid of the loopholes and fix asylum. If so..."
Okay, once we put all the corrupt ones in jail, I think we'll be able to accomplish some of these things. But go ahead.
That's where I'm really excited because...
Yeah?
Yeah, Barr. Barr is going after him. He's going after all of them. That, get this, man, Obama's right in the thick middle of it. Not only the whole Democrat Party. That means Pelosi, Schumer, all of those rats.
I wouldn't say the whole, but a good deal of them. And don't forget there's Republicans in there, too. Not as many as there are Democrats, but there are Republicans that played the game.
Yeah, but he's going after the state. Now, Hillary was the queen bee of the State Department. That place is riddled with Obama leftovers. They're doing everything they can to stop Trump. And, you know, a good toilet flush there would be great.
Yeah, no doubt.
But anyway, I had to share this with you. I mean, it's so priceless. They're finally going to do something. I live in California, and I got to tell you, all of these illegal aliens, they're driving around without insurance. They get in accidents. They steal people's property. They break into houses. They sell drugs. They're all over the... We're infested with them. And I don't know, we get rid of all these illegal people and maybe we can have honest voting for a change and get some of these damn Democrats out of office.
We definitely are heading to that. I'm convinced of that. Look at, you know, after Trump took office, it took a little while and I saw all the work this guy was doing and we're wondering, well, what's going on with the bad stuff? And we're waiting and looking and watching. He's saying all the right things. He's doing all the right things. He delivered the right message to the United Nations. He took control of the United Nations. He took control of the Federal Reserve. You know, he's doing some heavy duty things there, especially with the speech he gave to them and letting them know with no uncertain terms, you know, look at, we're going back to the Republic. And so with all that being done, and then finally Q comes into the scene and we start to see what's going on and see all the activity and we see everything that Q is saying is coming to pass, and boy, we know things are happening. These are exciting times.
Right. There was also a lady that I saw her video today, and she was talking about how the vaccines are tainted. And she has proof about it. Her life was a living hell, but finally she's getting recognition. It's coming full center. Yeah. It's been going on for 40 years with the vaccine.
Yeah.
When are we going to square away the courts so we don't have vaccine court or tax court? When can we
look at we're trying to hit a big lump of that all at the same shot with our paperwork, okay? And we have to cover all of the corruption going on. It's going to be so overwhelming, it's undeniable, okay? And we do have some great evidence. We've got We've got even a lot of things we have to say are self-evident. They know the truth about common law, especially the United States Supreme Court does. They know what's going on in the federal district courts. They know about the corruption. They know these judges are in bad behavior, and yet they have done nothing. Congress knows these judges are in bad behavior, and they got the power and the authority to impeach them for, and remove them for bad behavior. And since they're not going to do it, we the people are going to do it with indictments, because it's our unalienable right to do so. And it's written right clearly inside our Declaration of Independence, the power and the authority of the people, and a right for them to alter government when it goes awry again, you know. So, but, and we got to stop pressing these people, and we're going to be pressing them, and we're going to be pushing them, and prodding them, and we're going to be talking with Barr. We're sending all our paperwork to Barr. We're sending our paperwork to the President of the United States, both houses of Congress. We're going to serve them, you know, because they're in a lawsuit. We're going after the justice, you know, judicial system by going after the top, which is the United States Supreme Court. They're the ones that's responsible for a lot of this, and they allow all these stupid rules. They've allowed the court system, the court of laws, to be totally concealed, and they've shut the doors and prevent anyone from getting access to real courts of law. They know what's going on. They're not stupid, and they allow it to happen. They're participating. Now I understand. You know, you take someone like Scalia. You know, he knew his life was on the line, and I do believe he was assassinated. But in any event, you know, he was kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. I understood that he couldn't really do much, but he did throw some bones out to us. After all, he gave us United States versus Williams in 1992? I think that was, or 91. I forget what year that was, but it was in the early 90s, and. So he gave us some really good bones, and yet he really couldn't do anything. And I don't know how much support he had on the court system, but we also know that they all had guns to their head, because the deep state controlled everything, and there were spies everywhere, and the CIA involved, and all this stuff. We know it's all there. We know that the powers that be, you know, gets up into the elite system, a couple of hundred families at most, probably somewhere between 100 to 200, from what I understand. And so they're stuck. But now, right now, with the environment, what's happening, they have no excuse. You know, a lot of people thought, for instance, Giuliani was corrupt. And they thought, well, he knew what was going on, and he did know what was going on. He knew what happened. He didn't know when it was happening, what was happening with 9/11, but he knew not long after that, and he understood. And yet he didn't do nothing. Why? He couldn't. They had a gun to his head. But now that he's got the opportunity and he's working with Trump, and remember, they're buddies. They go back. They're both from New York City, you know. And believe me, Trump was very, very close with Giuliani and many others. That was part of his circle, and I'm sure some of his private conversations of the corruption and what's going on, what needs to be done. And finally, when he was able to do something, and the word is that he was kind of called into duty, and he's been wanting to run or thinking to run for quite a few years before, but then I think he probably was called into duty, and he did take the opportunity because he was ready, and he was the right guy at the right time with the right knowledge and the abilities to deal with all of our problems. The man is a genius businessman, if there is such a thing. He really understands the system. He understands how to deal with people, talk with people. He can articulate himself right. And he's a regular guy, you know. You know, they try to attack him because he's a regular guy. He's not a politician. He knows a lot more, you know, than they ever dreamed. And they thought he was, you know, I don't know what they thought. But he outsmarted, he outfoxed them all. And he's got them all. They're all going down now as we speak. It's just amazing.
Good.
But anyway, hopefully the United States Supreme Court is going to get the backbone to step up. Hopefully we're going to get enough people in the Congress, the good people, to step up and get back and bring this country back under the rule of the people. We have government by consent of the people. And you can't tell us we consent by going to a ballot box. That's a bunch of BS. We consent controlling the political process. We consent by controlling the courts, and that's how we consent to government. And when we control those two points, we control it all.
John, Mr. Durash,
yeah.
Please.
Yeah.
I know you're on a roll, and you want to keep going, but I've got to say something that's just burning in my soul.
We're running out of time, too. So.
You need, I think, to write another paper. And I think this paper needs to address Congress, because Congress is derelict in their duties.
Oh, we are going after Congress.
Just a minute. Let me finish. Then you excoriate them. The thing is, what Congress has done is they have written very vague law. And whenever they write vague law, the agencies like the IRS or the FBI or Department of Energy or Homeland Security or whatever other bizarre 10th Amendment violation that's floating around out there in alphabet soup, they write their own guidance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as a national grand jury and people that are not submitting to this tyrannical overburden by these agencies, we need to rein them in. If Congress doesn't write it right, give it back to Congress. There should be absolutely no supervisory action at all by these agencies. They are supposed to be slaves. They're servants to Congress. That's it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
They can't write their own legislation. We need to cram that down their throats and void every lawsuit that has ever come out of it since they started using guidance.
Well, that's why we're trying to get this joinder thing going, and it's become pretty popular. We got quite a few people have already started applying, and we're just really getting started on this. And this will continue as long as we're in the process of going after these people. And until we get our courts of records open everywhere, where we have common law courts running under natural law, until that happens, we will continue to collect people and the assaults upon people. Also, listen, anybody who's got a slam dunk case, okay, of anyone that's in jail and should not be there, we are going to approach the president for pardons. We got a couple of people already we're trying to get things together on, and anybody that has a case or knows of a case, but you'll have to do an affidavit on that case, and it has to be rock solid that these people really just don't belong in jail at all. And I'll tell you what, these people that put some of the Bundy clique, and I don't want to call it that, but it wasn't the Bundys themselves because they didn't go to jail, but some of the people involved up there in Oregon that did go to jail because they worked out and they pleaded out because they put the fear of a huge sentences before them, I'm sure of 20, 30 years or something, but they pleaded out with a couple of years, and they're still in jail. And yet that case, that was acquitted. They were acquitted. Everybody was acquitted. What are these people doing in jail? There was no crime. Everybody was acquitted, you know? So anybody who has some strong cases and can get the people involved or themselves to write an affidavit that's really powerful on a serious case, we'll add it into our paperwork we'll be sending to the president for pardons.
I think it should be a standard piece of paper that whenever a person is in court and they're being charged with some guidance crime, that there should be a document you could present that the statute they're using has no standing in law and is not legal. This is color of law. Throw it out.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's simple. That's straightforward. And sue them for abuse and wasting your time, court costs, all of that.
Well, no doubt. No doubt. So
I mean,
we got to go after them.
The Bureau of Land Management was doing exactly that. It was guidance that screwed those people over.
Mm-hmm.
And then they've got FBI and DEA. I mean, you got the CIA. They're being dissolved right now. Did you hear that?
The what?
They're breaking up the CIA.
Oh, yeah, I heard that yesterday. I think it was on X-22 talking about it.
Yeah, I just got one glimpse of it. Boy, that's beautiful. Break those guys.
Oh, absolutely. They got to go down.
Yeah, no kidding. They've been starting wars all across this planet.
Yeah, they're the arm of destruction, you know, no doubt about it. All right, look, we've got time. We got one other caller on the line. So
I'm out of here. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Fred. Appreciate it. Come back for more spin, the right kind of spin. All right, we've got one other call. If anybody else, well, getting kind of late. We'll see what happens. So we're going to take this last call at least. And
954, you got the mic. Go right ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. Yourself?
Okay, we have a big issue down here in Miami-Dade. Miami-Dade, Florida, we do not have a sheriff, an elected sheriff here.
Is that the only county?
I'm sorry?
Is that the only county that doesn't have an elected sheriff, or all counties?
The only county that I know of, the only Broward County has it, West Palm Beach, all the other counties in Florida that we know of has sheriffs.
Do you know why they don't have an elected sheriff?
It's been over 10 years, and they have not had it in 2000.
Go get yourself the Constitution for Florida and see what it says about the sheriff. I know here in New York, it's clear about the sheriff.
They have to have it. They have to have it.
Right.
This is, and that's what I'm raising, is the fact that what I'm trying to do is get a group together. We're trying to get a group together to sue Miami-Dade, the county, because there was issues. Like, I had an issue in 2015 where I was falsely accused of child abuse when I brought my baby to the hospital, but it come to find out she had metabolic bone disease, which is rickets. And I fought it for 4 years. They're crooked, a child's court. At the time, I didn't have as much knowledge as I have now. It just took 8 weeks, and they just railroaded me through the court. Not even court. It's not a court, but that corporation, the Title IV, B, Title IV E. Through that, just learning a lot, I just started teaming up. I started doing a lot of activist work, started learning laws, different things like that. And come to find out, when they removed my baby, even under their own DCF handbook, it says when a child is being removed, it has to be a DCF agent and a sheriff. My baby, both of my children, they took.
First of all, they have to have the authority to remove the child, too. They
right.
have to be in a court of law to move a child. You can't move it from an equity court, a court that operates
right.
under statutes, which
right.
you know, is a quasi-de facto court to begin with jurisdictions
right.
on
the beginning. From the beginning. But anyways, as of May 16th this year, I got acquitted. For the whole, the judge saw through it. He was probably the only sensible judge because he saw the facts in the case and saw that, you know, there was no proof of anything, you know, and that it was a metabolic bone disease. The doctors should just state doctors. And they railroaded me. I was able to get a habeas corpus back in to the federal court. They recognized it, but I went to, I think, the Florida Supreme Court with the habeas corpus, I'm sorry, and they sent it down to the lower court, which is supposed to be the state, you know, court of record down there. And they sent it back to this quasi-kangaroo court called the Child's Court. When I first started this case in 2015, I sued the judge. At the time, I didn't have much knowledge, as I know now, like I said, but I was trying to do everything I could do to... and I didn't consent to anything. That's the next thing. I didn't consent to anything in a court. At least I knew back then not to sign anything, and I didn't sign anything with that court. But I sued the judge, and the first thing I got was a call from the New York Times asking me to – they wanted to write a story on it, but I didn't go further past it. Is this new court that they called – the Children's Court, which we know is not a court. It's just under the Title IV-B. Sorry, is it E or B? E. The statutory courts. And they don't have there's no constitutional anything, no matter how much I raise my constitutional this and that. Trial by jury, there's no trial by jury. Murderers have more rights. There's no constitutional rights. Parents have no, they just railroad us. They just railroad us through these child courts. Well, that child court down there in Miami-Dade. But back to my point, I got to learn that Miami-Dade doesn't have a sheriff. So there's been a lot of foreclosures down here. There's been a lot of, you know, DCF removals. There's been warrants served. And it's the Miami-Dade Police Department that is doing it. So as of 2025, they say that they're going to put in a sheriff. 2025, they're going to put in the sheriff. But from years on, people have been hurt from the sheriff department. I mean, a lot of people down here, I'm sure they don't know, because Miami-Dade, there's a lot of Cuban, a lot of Haitian, there's a lot of, you know, cultural people, you know, where they're just, it's not that, they're not really aware of the laws. Let me, how can I say it? you know, they're just coming into the country, so they're just saying, let's just adapt, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's not like they're looking for, my husband, he's signed up to your common law grand jury, and he's been doing all your tests and everything. He finished all of them. I think, was there one to say that there was a...
Under construction.
One was under construction or something like that. So he wasn't... The government by consent. But we're really good at, our laws and knowing what's the difference between, you know, a lot of stuff. And we listen to you all the time. But, there isn't any sheriff. So what we wanted to do was get a few people that we know that are fighters down here in Miami-Dade to come to do a really big suit against the county for this, for all the violations. Because, like I said, there's no sheriff, and it hasn't been for about 10, 15 years. No elected official. And a lot of lawyers don't even know. A lot, because we bump into people all the time. We just ask, really even ask a Miami-Dade officer, hey, why do you have a sheriff? And they'll say, well, we're the sheriff. I said, no, it isn't. You have Miami-Dade Police Department on your badge. You're not a sheriff, and you're not elected, you know? And, you know, they'll go into whatever, then they'll finally break and say, yeah. I mean, they're in the court. They are in
We have kind of the same problem here in New York, because we have 7 counties that do not have sheriffs, 5 counties which make up New York City that do not have sheriffs. And then Westchester County, which is county number 6, does not have a sheriff. And then I'm not sure, I think it's Nassau County. You know, there's 2 counties out in Long Island here, Suffolk County and Nassau County. And I think it's Nassau County that doesn't have a sheriff. So that's number 7. And we intend on doing something about it, but we can't do anything right now. We've got too many things going on, and it's a battle we'll take into the federal court, because it's an unalienable right of the people to have a constitutional officer, and the Constitution, the New York State Constitution, requires it, and common law requires it. So it's something we're going to take up, and when we take it up, maybe, Connecticut, I'd like to take Connecticut up with it. There's 8 counties out there, and none of them have sheriffs. There's another problem with that.
Miami's the biggest county.
Maybe we can add in and do Florida at the same time, you know?
Yeah, it's horrible down here, because even Broward County that does have a sheriff, we had an issue up there with a young lady that she got upset with us because we sued her. And what she did was we helped her out with some foreclosure paperwork. We all sat together and did it together, but she got pissed off because we sued her. And we won. We won the suit, but she agreed, just walked in there and did a stipulation, and got upset a month later and filed charges with the state saying that we're practicing law without a license. Now, yeah.
Well, if you file it correctly, you open up a court of record, you file it correctly, you make it clear what the meaning of a court of record is, and that you're under natural law, they can't get you for operating without a license, because that's a statutory thing. And,
right.
And remember, I don't know. Look, I don't believe any lawyer really has a license. What I understand, it's sort of like it's a bar card which claims to be a license. But the United States Supreme Court has already talked about that you can't license that industry or anything of that nature. The court of law, you can't license that. Now, it is true that we do need lawyers that are educated in the equity courts, because just in the federal courts alone, we have 56, titles. So you have 56 specialties, and we do need, people that understand those. And half of them, by the way, is administrative, and the other half is what's called positive law, which is human law or legislated law. They call it positive law. And so half of the titles are positive law. The other half is just equity. You know, it's really they're all equity, but the other half is administrative. But you need specialties in all of them. And so people, that's where lawyers belong, working in those courts. But when they bring lawyers into the courts that are common law courts, they have to operate in a different way. They have to understand the common law, and they have to proceed accordingly. They can't be bringing those statutes into the courts. Now, of course, you can bring a statute into a common law court when you're using a statute for the obedience and the requirement of someone of authority that's breaking that authority. You can use their statutes against them because they're
right.
governed in by those statutes.
Yeah,
and that's
the thing. That what I was leading to is two things with that allegation. One, when the sheriff, because they gave us a warrant, there was a warrant issued, and we went to the courts to get some stuff, and they got us there. But the warrant was not signed, and back to, because I was saying that even though Broward County has a sheriff, the warrant was not signed by the judge. There is no one signed. It was a clerk's assistant that signed the warrant, and we put in our motion, of course. We put our motions in to challenge the jurisdiction and everything, so we're just waiting until that time because we haven't heard it yet. But we had it in from April 29th, and the prosecutor, it's been over 45 days, and he did not respond. So we were thinking of putting in an affidavit of default judgment
absolutely go through that. Sure, if you filed all your papers correctly and everyone was served correctly and they went past their 30 days and they did not respond, that's a default. You file an affidavit of default and you bring it in for execution, enforcement.
Yeah. So do we do it the same day that we go in again? We're supposed to go back on July 17th to challenge
your decision. I'd do it before that. If at this point, and you bring it into the court, and I'd bring it in and take it to the clerks, file it with the clerk. An interesting story. We had a situation going up after, I think it was credit cards, and it was one of the people that work with us here at National Liberty Alliance, and. And we went into the court. We fought that for a while, and some good stuff came out. And then what happened was they tried to reinstate this thing, but they had defaulted, okay? And so they called for a court date to come up, and we went into the court. And 2 days before that court case, we went down to the county, to the clerk, and we filed an affidavit of default. And we got the papers, we got them sealed, it was registered, put into the case. We took it into the court, and we told the judge, hey, case is over. Now, he was sticking up for the other side, trying to beat this guy up, but we had won the court, and he tried everything he could, but we denied him all the way down, and we walked out and never went back again. Case over, case closed. So, yeah, get your default right now. Walk into that courtroom. You got to think on how you want to do that. You might want to notify the judge and say, hey, cancel the date because we got a default here and file it with the court. File it with the court and don't say nothing to the judge and let's see what he does and then bring it into the court. He should know. But that's how bad.
Yeah, that's what we were thinking about doing. Yeah, we were thinking about doing that. Yeah, just wait until the 17th and then just, put it on record before then and just file it because and he doesn't look because the argument is too powerful.
Before you get there. Get it done. Do it right away.
Yeah.
Don't wait.
Yeah. So do you think that we should go ahead and sue the county for not having the sheriff and all the violations that they're doing? I mean,
if you know how to do it and you're able to bring it into the court, articulate yourself and try to open up a court of record, because that's your big battle to begin with. And we're going to have a new strategy on that. After we file our case, we're going to reveal a brand new strategy on opening up a court of record. And, people could try to do it the way we're going to do it.
Well, Miami-Dade is a big county. It's a huge county. And we both know, we know that it's going to be a big can of worms because there's nothing but mobsters down here, in the courts. Mm-hmm. I can't say all because in my situation, the judge that I had, even though I believe in the common law, he was a biblical man and he saw that. So he's rare, and they actually tried to get at him for acquitting me. But he said mm-hmm. there was no evidence, there's none, there was nothing. And they just railroaded me because I was a fighter. From the beginning, I fought. And I always tell people, and I heard you say this even last week to the lady on the lady who called in who had a ticket or something, and she was driving without a license. when you're a part of their courts, no matter how you come in and you say this, oh, you know, blah, 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 you have to be versed.
You got to be ready, absolutely.
You have to be.
Remember also, you can object to a lot of things going on in the court, make your notes, go home, and then write your papers and file it. Here's my objection, because, the judge may say, oh, what are you objecting for? And you can basically tell them and say, look, I'm going to support my objection in writing. I'm not a lawyer here, and I'm not educated in law in the schools or anything, so I got to go home and do some homework, put it together, and I'll file it in the court. And that's how you want to do it. You want to be careful what you do say in court when you're in court, because if you speak too much, you may end up get stuck in. They may catch you somewhere, and you'll undo what you already filed. And the last thing you stated was what's going to hold. So you got to be careful, and you got to really think about what you're going to say and think about what you're saying. And you're better off going home and thinking about it, writing your papers and filing them.
Right, because we're taking on that case in Broward by ourselves. We're doing it we stand firm with that, because the allegation that she has is just because we sued her. So she just, and it's amazing that they actually made it a felony with no proof and no evidence, and we don't know. It's so strange how they do that down here. It's just one person out, just saying anything. And we even read her, let me just tell you this really quick. When it first happened, I was still having that case in Miami-Dade before the acquittal. And once you get arrested or in one place, if you have a court, I don't get in problems. This is like the most problems I ever got with the child support and this issue, And then when I went down there, the judge in Miami-Dade who had my the criminal case with the child court, he read over her statement and he says, "Where's your proof?" And he's looking at the card that says, "We do not practice law. We perfect the common law," And we don't know how she got that for our house, because it was just a little rough drafting that we were putting together. And he says, "Is this your only evidence?" He was referring to the prosecutor. He said, "This doesn't even look right." And when I read over her statement doesn't even make any sense, because she kept on saying that I didn't have anything to do with it, and that, she's only upset over, that we sued her and won,
Mm-hmm.
So the judge was like, "Isn't it strange?" All the while, they worked with her for a whole year, and everything was fine until they did the stipulation and won, and now all of a sudden they're practicing law. Isn't that strange? The judge said it.
Yeah.
The judge said it, and this is not the Broward County judge, but the Dade County judge who, because the prosecutor went to him and tried to revoke my bond, and the judge was like, "No, I'm not going to do that. This lady's, whoever's in Broward, we don't even see how," he said, "I don't understand why does it even, go anywhere. This doesn't even make any sense."
Right.
So he was shocked himself, like, why would they even take on this case, But they did, and it's strange because that's the first time my husband ever got arrested and the second time I ever gotten any issue. And like I said, the first time was because I just walked into a hospital taking my child to the doctor, and I was accused. That's how messed up Dade County is, and that's why we wanted to shine a light on the sheriff's department, because there's a lot of stuff going on down here. I don't know if you guys heard of like the so-called Parkland shooting and stuff in Broward County. So they're really getting on like the FBI, and they're getting on a lot of these, officers. And that's why we wanted to shine the light on the sheriff's department, how they were moved and did a lot of foolishness, and they're doing a lot of stuff acting as sheriff, Do you know any law say that they can't do that?
That's pretty sad when they tell you that they're the sheriff, and, that's pretty bad. All right, it's over time, and it's time to close down, so hopefully you come back next week, and if you have more, you can bring these things up. And I'd like to hear from that woman who was going into the court to see how she made out with the traffic court, which she went in there on the man on the land stuff, which is very dangerous stuff to do. I used to do it myself. We tried that stuff. It failed. And as we started to study more and more, we realized that what we're doing is we are giving them authority by using their stuff and making certain claims So we're playing in their sandbox, acknowledging them, but they, you know, as their authority, but you don't have authority on me because I've done all the right thing and wrote my papers and filed it and clipped my heels and I'm out of here. Of course, that doesn't work anyway. And they come down harder on those people. I'm going to tell you right now, much, much harder. So you got to be careful. All right, with that, we're going to close down. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Okay, good night, everybody. Lord willing, we'll see you next Monday. Hopefully, I'll be here. Good night.